Blog Talk Radio.
Uh-oh. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Put the 3-in-1 oil away. We want to keep that squeak in that door. Good evening. Welcome to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show, here along with
Dave Binkley from Weirdness Really Bad Movie and Spaceship One, and also connecting with us tonight,
Tim Ahrens, author of Dark Creatures, A Simple Game, and Dark Creatures, The Grand Game.
And of course,
and last,
the amazing
and
wonderful.
Oh,
lady.
Greetings and felicitations. CW here to keep the road ahead smooth.
Yeah, and so she's got her work cut out for her.
There you go. welcome back, Tim. You were on, what, just a little more than a year ago with part one, or book one, of Dark Creatures, A Simple Game. And now now your second book is out.
Yeah, it just got released on Amazon in May, and I think the official launch is June 7th. So I'm also going to have an audiobook with this one, as well as an ebook.
Excellent. And the title this time, The Grand Game.
Yeah, which means that it's larger and more out of control than the first one.
familiarize us, if you would, with some of your characters and the storyline thus far, without too many spoilers.
Okay, sure. If you go back to the first book, The Simple Game, it's a step back into fantasy slash reality sort of thing. So if you imagine that the world around you is all normal and everything is going the way it's supposed to go, you would never believe that if you were approached, this, say if you were on Facebook or something like that, about from a friend of yours or someone you friended who suggested you play a game that they're working on, that they're working on a computer game, and you decide to do so, that you would be stepping into a situation where that friend was actually a god that had been forgotten ages ago and is just amusing themselves while they wait for the end of eternity. And so you've entered their simple game. You and another person, not too far away from you, probably in the same area, and it's more like a game of good against evil. The interesting part about it, well, the secondary interesting part about it, is it's a multi-layered game. So when you start playing the computer game that this person approached you to do, or this god approached you to do that you didn't know was a god, and you create your own characters, you're actually creating another living individual in another dimension, in another world, to follow your instructions.
That's kind of cool. And I understand the flavor is kind of like a dark fantasy. Would sword and sorcery be the genre?
Yeah, it's role-playing sword and sorcery. So if you like RPG books, or if you've ever read a lot of those are really getting popular nowadays, it's a slice of life RPG and fantasy. And it's definitely dark fantasy, yeah, that's correct. I don't want to mislead anybody about that. It's Stephen King meets Lord of the Rings.
Nice.
Wow.
In the first book, we have William J. Donovan, which is our hero in the beginning, and Doug Pimpkin, which is our villain. And trust me, he's a villain. If you don't hate this guy and want him flogged by the end of the book, I'll be very surprised.
Yeah,
in fact, I've had several people tell me that they want to read the second book just so they can watch his demise.
If that actually happens.
Ooh. Yeah, if that actually takes place.
You have to read the book to find out. We were talking a little bit before we came on the air. A passion that I think at least two or three of us have had is the game Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a friend of mine introduced that to me when I was 14, and... It's just been with me ever since. I've branched out over the years to Gamma World. Here's a good one. Doctor Who I've played, Vampire, but role playing in general is just huge amounts of fun, and that's what got me into writing was actually Dungeons & Dragons, because after the first three or four games I game mastered, people wanted me to start writing some of these stories down. So.
Yeah. Game master has to have a good imagination, and I can see that being a good training ground for writing, because you're creating worlds, you're creating situations, you're working around living, breathing characters.
Yeah, but I totally agree. In fact, if you look at some of the actors that that came out in the 80s, 70s and 80s, Anthony Hopkins is a good one. He actually started with Dungeons & Dragons. There are quite a few actors that admitted that they started role-playing before they even went into acting.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, it always seemed like the best dungeon masters that I played with as a kid were the best storytellers and the most imaginative.
We try.
Yeah. And I remember,
Oh, go ahead.
You had to order.
I was just wondering. Yeah, point of order here.
Sorry.
I was looking at the map that you have in your book, Dark Creatures, A Simple Game, and, you know, you have it all portioned out nicely. I was just wondering if down the line, are you in the back of your mind possibly considering doing a role-playing game based on the characters you've created?
That's a great question. I'd love to do something like that if I had somebody I could collaborate with, because I'm not really good at designing role-playing game systems. I can come up with stories for them, or modules, as they used to call them, but I'm not really good at game systems.
Wow.
As you know, there are so many game systems out there right now, I wouldn't mind splitting something 50-50 if someone ever reads the book well enough, wants to work on it like that. I'm not against it, but right now I'm actually world-building. So after the grand game comes out, there'll be one more book to this series, and then the World of Dark Creatures branches off with new characters.
Wow. Am I the only one old? Oh, Dave, I just wanted to give you a heads up. Be ready, because it's storming over in my area. I may have to call back on the cell if something goes wrong.
Gotcha.
You may have to drive this thing. And conversely, if Dave winks out, we're getting some storms up here in Ohio. Am I the only one old enough to remember when you had to get Dungeons & Dragons through the mail? I mean, you had to mail out to Guy Jacks, and they had these little tiny brown booklets that were roughly about the size of a Reader's Digest for your monster manuals and your player instructions and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones that ever came. Guy Jacks ever came out with, and he developed that in his garage. And he actually did what I'm doing and a lot of other people have decided to do. He self-published that. So when I don't know how he got the advertising out for it, because it was in Lake Geneva, and he was just doing it himself with a couple other friends. But I guess that's why you had to get it in the mail, is because you had to contact him, and then he had to mail it out to you.
Yeah, and self-publishing was a whole different creature back then, because what you'd have to do is you'd have to order – you know, at least, close to 1,000 books in order for someone to do it. Nowadays, you can do it working with Amazon. It's kind of a print-on-demand thing. You don't have to buy extra ones. And I mean, you want to for when you go out and appearing and stuff, but you really don't have to. So it was a whole different creature back then.
Oh,
yeah.
I entirely agree. He came out. He was very very ingenious. He came out with Tractics, I guess, which was also a wargaming role-playing game tabletop game that you could play. He was extremely inventive when it came to that stuff.
Yeah, I mean there was no computerized versions or anything. You had to use paper, pencil. You had to even mail away for the polyhedron dice, those crazy sided dices. For the various results of the game, and it was fun and more imaginative, but yet they made it more fun as the game improved a lot of those early monster manuals had to be changed for copyright reasons, because there were the Howard characters and Michael Moorcock's world from Elric and things like that. They had to pull those.
Yeah, there was a great – oh, shoot, I've lost it. I had a great story, but I'll come back to me in a minute. But I guess they ended up, if I remember correctly, and don't quote me on this, but I think that they ended up even going after some of the Japanese anime people when they came out with Lotus War. Because they were borrowing from Dungeons & Dragons, and TSR didn't like that at all.
Yeah. Oh, once it gets big and money gets involved, it gets it gets like that, I guess.
Absolutely, always.
Go right ahead.
I was just going to say, I was just noting that I was wondering when you had your the village of Talong Village and the Keep of Laguerre, did you go to linguistics? Because Laguerre is war in French, and Talong, I think that's an Indonesian word for help.
I actually, if you pay attention to the first book, not so much in the second book because I was trying to move along and tie up some knots, but in the first book, if you pay attention, there's a lot of Easter eggs in there for verbiage and words.
Okay, I thought I was just overdoing things, so I'm not crazy. Okay, thank you.
Oh, no, you're not. For instance, I purposely didn't go into massive amounts of detail on the forgotten gods that are involved in the game, in the simple game and in the grand game in the second book, simply because I was hoping that a lot of the younger people, if they decide they want to read it, like the Stephen King fans or the Dean Koontz fans or something like that, might want to study up on some of these gods because it's fascinating to actually look into them. And if you explain them too much in a book, people will say, oh, okay, well, I know that item, and I'm not going to look into it. I'd kind of rather have somebody look into Circe or the Januses from the Roman gods and stuff like that.
And is it from the first book, you referenced the Pale Rider. Are we referencing the Judeo-Christian Bible or Clint Eastwood?
Wouldn't you like to know?
A little of each, maybe.
Yeah, you really won't find out exactly who the Pale Rider is until the end of the third book, the fourth book, which is one I'm going to start to work on shortly. Then I'll give you the identity, the true identity of who the Herald of the Gods is right now. But right now he's just the Herald of the Gods. He's running around kind of like a referee. He runs around and tries to keep the peace and make sure that everything is balanced and works out right, which doesn't always work. He's kind of like the game master, if that's what you can consider it. You have the players, which are the gods, and then you have the players, which are the humans, and then the players, which are the fantasy individuals, and then you have the Pale Rider, or the Ragman, as some people call him, insultingly, of course, who just runs around and tries to keep everything balanced so it doesn't get out of control. Unfortunately, this game went from a simple game, it was only supposed to be a very simple game, to, good versus evil, one and one, this one accelerates to the point where it's in danger of actually being figured out by people who are actually in the real world, noticing the differences of what's going on since things change drastically once things get out of control. Why do they get out of control? It's because there are other people who are now meddling their fingers into this particular situation for their own purposes. Behind the scenes, a group of those people are called the Putrid Ones, and it's yep. And I took that as a nod, along with another guy I created for the book, as a nod to H.P. Lovecraft, because I really believe that he's one of the fathers of modern horror. He was one of the people who started this whole trend, in my opinion.
I'm looking at the cover here, and I'm thinking back to being young and having lots of time to read 70s through the 80s. I would have been drawn to this book. You got a good artist there doing your covers.
Yeah, Atmosphere Press, who, as I went through for the second book for the Grand Game, actually did a fantastic job with it. The interior work, the typing and the interior design looks really beautiful. They did a great job setting up the print work. They did a beautiful job translating my artist, which is named James Reich. If anyone's interested, he does a lot of beautiful dark fantasy artwork. And I can always put you in touch with him if you want. There's a little nudge there. I'm sorry.
As a Frank Frazetta fan, I may take you up on that.
Oh, by all means, he does a fantastic job with his artwork, and he did all of the black and white artwork on the inside of the first and second book.
If I could throw a compliment and gush a little bit, I think you are following in the fantastic footsteps of Martin, father of Game of Thrones, in the fact that he has been famously quoted as, when he was asked, how do you write your female characters? I write them as they are human beings, considering that in many of other sword and sorcery things, they're just there for a window dressing, if you will.
All of my characters are powerful. If they're a main character in my book, they have a purpose. They're all powerful. Their gender, whether they're male or female, doesn't matter to me as far as, except for, you know, circumstances of where they were born or what might fit well enough into the story. But their abilities are never going to be seconded because of their gender. There's always a Conan and a Red Sonja, for instance. Red Sonja is the same as Conan. She's as strong as Conan is, if you read the books. But
yeah, I did read the book Red Sonja and the movie Red Sonja, the first one. It kind of started out promising, but it kind of petered out very quickly. Yeah,
you have to go, if you really want Red Sonja for who she's supposed to be, you got to go into the comic books. If you look for her in, I think they have a new series out of Red Sonja out nowadays. She could give Conan a run for his money as far as a fight goes, as far as with swords and fists and whatever else happens to be the case.
Yeah, I think his only advantage would be size. And my first exposure to Red Sonja was actually in these reprints of the old Robert E. Howard stuff.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Please continue. Sorry.
There was a book I read back, oh, God, it must have been 85, 86. It's called The Swordswoman. I really wish I could tell you who wrote it. I don't remember the author right now. It presented in that book, the setting was in the Orient in Japan, in ancient Japan, and they presented that same quandary about a male swordsman against a female swordsman. Because there was a female who wanted to avenge her family in the book, and she wanted to take her sword up against them, and she knew nothing about sword fighting, so she had to go and find someone who would train her. Most samurai didn't train women at that particular period. It was a really beautifully written book, but anyway.
Yeah.
And she came up to the trainer, and she said, "Well, I want you to show me how to use this sword so that I can strike down the men who destroyed my village and stuff like that." And the trainer said, "Well, attack me." So the female character ran up to him with a sword like any other person would, swinging the sword, and he knocked her right on the ground. He said, "See, that's my point. Women will never be able to defeat a man head-on with a sword. What you have to do is be able to learn the gifts that the gods have given you and use them. So you have to use your speed and your agility and your ability to move beyond what a male would do who would just use his strength of his muscles to force you back."
Yep.
That's what you have to learn.
That's the gist I got out of Robert E. Howard's interpretation, that Conan was more powerful, but Red Sonja was more agile and faster.
Mm-hmm. So I always took that to heart when I write my female characters. A lot of them, unless they have extraordinary abilities like Augury Parse, who has abilities on her own, or Lilica, which is Trevelyan, which is my bard. Each of those characters have abilities above and beyond a human norm, so they could do that. They could face off against Conan head to head. But if I write an actual normal female character without any extraordinary abilities, she'd use her mind or her reflexes or her speed or something like that. She'd never hit a man head on who's bigger than she is, because it's suicide, in my opinion. Of course, I'm sorry, I don't mean to ruffle any feathers.
Yeah.
So.
Oh no. Not at all. Fight dirty. Everyone hearing, remember, do what mom said,
Yep.
Hit hard, hit fast, hit low.
Hitting the right spot. That's right.
Yeah, there's a great story about Bruce Lee when you talked about that. I know a whole lot about a whole lot of stuff that doesn't really matter. There's a great story where he was talking to an actor. He was on a film. It was a secret agent film. I can't think of what it was. It was a TV show.
Oh, Green Hornet.
It wasn't the Green Hornet though. It was like Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
It wasn't Man from U.N.C.L.E. At least I don't believe it was. But anyway, and he had the actor down, and the character was asking him how to defeat this opponent that he could defeat. And Bruce Lee looked at him and said, "Well, you know, he's got him in this chokehold." And he said, "Okay, now what do you do?" And Bruce Lee looks at him and goes, "Well, you bite. You scratch, you punch, you do everything you possibly can to get out of the hold you're in right now." And so the character in the show said, "Well, isn't that unfair and dishonest?" He said, "Well, if you won't fight dirty in a situation where you can't win, then you must learn to do one more thing: prepare to lose."
Yeah.
Nicely said. I should take a needlepoint and make a sampler of that.
There's a lot of great one-liners.
Hey, Dale, we should give Tim a chance to catch his breath and catch the first part of our story.
Yeah, we do have an old-time radio program, if you don't mind, Tim. We can get into part one. We can catch our breath for about 15 minutes with part one of CBS Radio Mystery Theater. This one's called The Secret of the Fifth Bell.
And it is from March 12th of 1980, just 1980, and episode number 1067.
We'll be right back. Stick around.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents... Welcome. I'm E.G. Marshall. The Orient and Oriental ways have always been a puzzle to the West. The shrines, tea houses, ancient rites, pagodas in Kyoto, the Hall of Dreams, the amalgam of art and artifacts, all having dark and sealed meanings, most of which escapes us, as it did Franklin Phillips, who thought a curse was a blessing in disguise.
Can I show you something in antiques?
A few weeks ago, you sold a Japanese temple gong to my wife.
I never sold it. I never had such a thing in my store.
Of course you sold it. Remember? Japanese, six bells on a silken cord.
I never had such a thing in my life. What are you talking about? I tell you, I never sold it. You are in the wrong store.
Our drama, The Secret of the Fifth Bell, was adapted from a story by Jacques Futrelle, especially for the Mystery Theater by G. Frederick Lewis, and stars Earl Hammond. It is sponsored in part by True Value Hardware Stores. I'll be back shortly with Act One.
This is Gene King for your Better Business Bureau. If your food bills have become astronomical, it's time for you to learn the secrets of the smart shopper. Plan your shopping trips in advance. Also, try not to go when you're hungry. By making a shopping list and sticking to it, you'll be less tempted to buy on impulse the things you really don't need. Consider seasonal bargains, advertised specials, and the dietary needs of your family when you make out your list. But remember, folks, buying sale items in bulk is just fine, but only if you're able to store them properly. Now, another thing you should also do is read food labels so you know exactly what you're paying for before you buy it. For example, you may decide to pass up that can of beef stew that's such a steal when you read that it contains more water than beef and potatoes. Be a smart shopper. Plan and save. A tip from your Better Business Bureau.
about as far from the humble worship of Buddhism as time, place, and intent can take us. But before this story is done, we shall be drawn back to that ancient worship. At this moment, however, our concern is with a mansion on the northeast coast, particularly with its owner, who sits astride shipping lines, oil fields, factories, and stock exchanges like a colossus, wielding the dollar wand over an empire. Meet Franklin Phillips, whose wife softly enters the great man's study and kisses him.
Norma, sweetheart, what a nice surprise to see you in the middle of the day.
Oh, Frank, dear, did you think I'd forgotten your birthday? I know you don't like being disturbed when you're working at home, but this once I shall.
By golly, I'm 50 years old today.
And I have a present for you. Giles, bring in the box.
Happy birthday to you, Mr. Phillips.
Set the box right here on his desk, Giles. I'll open it.
50 years. Yeah, that's half a century.
Oh, Methuselah.
Temple bells. Giles, give Mrs. Phillips a hand. She'll never be able to lift those.
Uh-huh.
Six of them, all tied together, all different sizes. Hold them up high, Giles.
Yes, sir.
Oh, they're bronze, aren't they?
Yes.
Norma, I've never seen anything like them. Sort of inverted bowls hung one on top of the other.
And very, very old. Oh, look at the workmanship, Frank. That lovely design. You know, what attracted me was a circle with three dots inside and three rays extending from it. Oh, which bell was it on? Can you spot it, Frank?
There it is, Norma. The circle with the three rays at the bottom of the fifth bell.
Ah, yes.
Norma, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever received. It's worth being half a century old for.
Oh, come now.
We'll hang it right up here in front of the west window, where I can always see it from my desk. Norma, to you goes the honor of striking the first bell. Here's a letter opener.
Oh, it's the fifth bell that intrigued me.
Giles, hold the bells higher, please.
Yes, sir.
All right. Here goes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Giles, what is it that Kipling said?
Oh, Frank, aren't you asking a little much of your administrative secretary?
Oh, Giles will know. He knows everything.
Well, at least let him put the bells down on your desk before his arm falls off. They're heavy.
May I, sir? Well, I think the phrase Mr. Phillips was referring to was east is east and west is west. And never the twain shall meet.
Of course. And these bells prove old Rudyard was wrong. They suit me perfectly and will look great hanging up here.
Well, I haven't the faintest idea where they're from. Neither did the lady who sold them to me. She just knew they were very, very old.
Any ideas, Giles?
Well, I would venture to say, sir, they are ancient Japanese, probably early 7th century, and most likely hung in one of the temples of the Horyuji at Nara.
Giles. Giles, come in here.
Yes, what is it, sir?
It just rang. Twice.
What did?
One of the bells there from where it's hanging.
Well, maybe the breeze from the window caught it.
Yeah. You see, it did it again. You were right here, Giles. You heard it.
Strange. Do you know which bell was rung?
No, I'm not sure.
Well, why don't we try them all, one at a time? Then we'll know which one it was.
Oh, do come in, Frank. Dinner will be ready when our guest arrives.
Let me sit down a moment.
Oh, what is it, dear? It's not like you to break off from work this early. Has anything gone wrong?
No, nothing's gone wrong. Business is booming, but...
But what?
Well, can you tell me where you got that Japanese gong?
Oh, well, of course I can. It's been in the window of this curio shop. And I've been passing it for months on my way to the community fund. So, one day I just went in and bought it. The shop's called Wagner's. It's on Cranston Street. An old German lady runs it. Why?
Did you pay a lot for it?
Oh, do you think I'm going to tell you? I'd say enough, but not too much.
Well, I was just
wondering how valuable it is.
Well, I like that. I never ask you how much you spend for my presents. But it'll be easy enough to find out what it's worth tonight, won't it?
It will.
Well, certainly, dear. Have you forgotten? We have Mr. Okumatsumi from your Japanese electronics subsidiary coming for dinner.
Oh, it completely went out of my head. Are you the proprietor?
Yeah.
You're Mrs. Wagner?
Yeah, Elizabeth Wagner. Can I show you some antiques?
Well, a few weeks ago, you sold a Japanese gong, actually six bells, different sizes, on a silken rope.
I never sold it. I never had a Japanese gong in my shop.
Well, of course you sold it. Do you understand? Japanese six bells on a silken cord?
I never had such a thing in my life. What are you talking about? I tell you, I never sold it. You are in the wrong store.
Excellent read, Mrs. Phillips. My compliments.
Oh, Mr. Matsumi, our pleasure. I'm always delighted when a guest eats everything on his plate.
Most satisfying. You have very tasty fat partridge in your country.
By the way, Matsumi, there's something I'd like to show you. Join me in my study, will you? How about some more sake?
No, thank you. When I travel, I prefer scotch.
Well, scotch we have, too. This is my study. I handle all my business from that desk. Different color phones, different color businesses.
Ah, so very color. Those beds hanging by the window.
Ah, you spotted them.
Where did you get them?
You like them? They're a present from my wife.
Excuse me. May I ask for silence, please?
Matsumi, why do you do that?
I beg your pardon?
Bowing down before the bells and then putting your right hand out and up as if making some symbol in the air?
Honored Phillips, my good friend, you could not understand significance even if I told you.
Well, I didn't mean to be disrespectful. On the contrary, Matsumi, I'm curious and I wish to learn.
I would like to examine more closely with your permission.
Well, my house is yours. What would you like to do?
Merely to touch this one bell with my finger. You have had this acquisition a long time?
Just a week.
And have you noticed anything out of the ordinary?
Matter of fact, I have.
It rings, does it not? The fifth bell, by itself.
Exactly, by itself. For no reason.
But you have not heard it ring 11 times.
No.
Ah. You will forgive me for the suggestion, but would you be willing to part with it?
Oh, I couldn't. As I told you, it was given to me by my wife as a special gift.
Then no offer I might make would be considered.
No, Matsumi, certainly not.
Then could you inform me where your wife bought it?
In a little curio shop on Cranston Street. I can't remember the address, but the proprietor is a German lady by the name of Elizabeth Wagner.
Thank you. It may be the shop has another.
I don't believe so, but it's worth a try.
Mr. Phillip?
Yes, Giles.
How did your dinner meeting go last night with Okumatsumi?
What?
Did you get them to increase their production of the 16K dynamic RAM chips?
Well, it was never a problem. I don't know why the man came here. We're in touch by phone twice a week. The entire evening, not one word about production.
Well, he had a good American meal. Yeah,
but that's not why he came. I'm wondering if it didn't have something to do with those bells. Speak of the devil. 5, 6, 7. This is going to drive me up the walls.
Frank, may I come in?
Please do. Come in, darling. My one note of sanity.
Giles was just leaving. Oh, Giles, the only letter I didn't sign was the one to Venezuela Petroleum. Redo it, Giles, as I've indicated in the margin.
9 tomorrow, sir?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, come anyway. You have the key. I may ask you to take that little spare bedroom by the library for a few days. I may have to do some late-night dictation.
Well, that's quite all right with me, Mr. Phillips. Good night, sir. Good night, Mrs. Phillips.
Good night. I don't know that it's good for you to be working late hours, Frank.
Good for me?
Well, you're getting awfully jumpy these days. I wish you'd go see Dr. Milburn.
Is that why you came in here? To tell me I was getting on your nerves?
Oh, you're getting on your own nerves, Frank. I came to ask you whether you particularly care for those Japanese bells you've hung up there.
Well, why do you ask me that? What suddenly made you ask me that?
Well, remember I told you I'd bought it from a German dealer on Cranston Street, a Mrs. Wagner. Well, this afternoon she sent a messenger with a note asking if I'd sell it back to her for $2,000. She must have found out it was more valuable than she thought. Oh, Frank, $2,000 would make such a nice donation to my community fund.
You mean she wants to buy it back now after what she told me?
What was that?
Oh, never mind. No, no, don't sell it to her, not at any price. I want it. I'll give you a check for $2,000 for your fund. What is it, Giles?
As I was leaving, a messenger handed me this note for you, Mrs. Phillips. Said he'd wait for an answer.
A note for me?
Well, what does it say?
Well, it's another message from the curio shop dealer. Oh, now she offers $5,000. $5,000.
Well, if old Mrs. Wagner keeps raising the ante, it's going to add a great deal to your community fund. Hand me my checkbook, will you, darling? Giles, tell the messenger there's no reply.
Franklin Phillips is nothing else if not stubborn. Is it because he must probe the secret of the fifth bell? Of course it is. Phillips is a man not easily dissuaded or defeated, but the very tenacity that has earned him world power may be his undoing. I shall return shortly with Act Two.
Where is that clerk? Oh,
can I help you?
We have to see the hotel manager.
Right away.
I'll get him.
And hurry. Oh, John.
It's okay. It's
our
okay.
Vacation's ruined.
Don't worry, honey. Please, maybe we can find someone who'll...
Hi, I'm the hotel manager.
Well, listen, we've lost our traveler's checks.
All of them. What should we do?
Well, what kind were they?
American Express.
Right. American Express. Come on, I've got their number right here.
Ah.
You can call for help anytime from anywhere in the country with American Express traveler's checks. Ask for them by name.
A message from CBS News.
In the whole frantic human scene, there is one place where time has a different meaning. That place is Egypt.
Share a fascinating tour of Egypt with Walter Cronkite and President Anwar Sadat.
Something that my grandmother taught me, the only eternal thing is land.
A CBS News special, Sadat's Eternal Egypt. Saturday at 10, 9 Central on the CBS Television Network.
There you go. Part one of The Secret of the Fifth Bell. We're back with author Tim Ahrens.
And I thank you guys for having me on again this year. I really definitely appreciate it. Your radio program is most excellent. In fact, listening to it reminded me of a couple of things. Abacus Films, I believe it was called Abacus. My pronunciation might be wrong. They took over for Hammer Films in England.
Yes.
Yeah, they actually had a movie out of short stories. I do believe it was called Tales from the Crypt, but I'm not entirely sure if that's the right episode. But anyway, it was about a curio shop owner who sold cursed items to people. And what it was a test of their honesty or their integrity. It was really a great film. It starred, Peter Cushing. Thank you. My brain started to work again.
Was there a Hammer film without Peter Cushing in it?
We're filled without Cushing in it, but he was such a great actor. I really hate to see them not use him.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Egyptian point at the end there reminded me of a episode of One Step Beyond, which I'd like to push for your listeners if they're interested in older film, older TV shows that were fantastically done. You can get that on Amazon, I guess. It's One Step Beyond. It's just fantastic.
One Step Beyond. You know what? We really don't know much about that show.
There it is.
we never discussed it. We never... So I'm glad you brought it to our attention, though, because...
Yeah, I never heard of that, that John Newman guy, long hair?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Now, listen to this real careful, Tim. Hold on a minute.
Yeah, that...
No, so wait, I want to experiment with you here a little bit. Now, we'll put that off for a minute, and I want you to listen again to our introduction for Erie House Radio after the squeak.
Oh.
There's a band that was playing extensively in the Canton area, I think, Dave, near you, called the Original Onions, and their stuff is available for use. I'm not sure if it's public domain. It's at least Creative Commons, but they've been wonderful to let me use their stuff for my horror hosting, and we use it a bit here on Erie House Radio. But I love this rendition they did of the One Step Beyond theme.
Well, what brought that to mind is that there's an episode I just got done watching the other night, since I have the set, about a World War II plane. He was a paratrooper who ended up dropping in the Egyptian desert. And I guess he was possessed by a pharaoh that was over 2,000 years old. It was really quite a great episode.
Oh, I haven't caught that one. I have to go back and catch that one, yeah.
So when he was talking about Egyptian sands and how the Egyptian sands move and stuff like that, that just reminded me of that episode.
I have a collection of all those. I have to dive for mine, too, now. I have to watch that one as well.
So yeah, as a writer, you're interested in old movies and old television. Are you a fan of the old radio shows as well?
Yeah, actually, when I get a chance to listen to them, I do. I listen to a lot of them. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, and they have a radio show that they play a lot of this stuff on Sunday nights after 8 o'clock. So, I tend to listen to those. And, I catch them on shows every once in a while. They're not as widely advertised as they used to be, though.
Well, we're trying to turn that around.
Oh, I'm trying to help you. Trust me. I've already recommended your show to quite a few people, and one person I recommended to put it on his phone. He loves it so much.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
Thank you.
Poor guy.
he needs
a hobby.
He thought your show was fantastic. In fact, he told me he was glad I actually recommended it.
Okay, so folks, you need to start buying books right now. No, in all seriousness, if someone wanted to buy your book, where would they go?
You can go to Amazon.com and look up Tim Ahrens under Dark Creatures. You can also go to the Atmosphere Press website. They can also hook you up with that. And hopefully my own website will be finished with the update for the book shortly.
Now, do you have paper copies as well as digital copies?
Correct. Yep, I have. I have a paper copy right now. June 7th, when the original launch takes place, I should have an ebook and a paper copy, and then hopefully shortly after that, I'll have an audio copy.
Nice.
So who did your audio? Out of curiosity,
and it'll also be Atmosphere Press.
Oh, they did the audio as well.
They're going to take care of all the publishing needs. Yeah. All I got to do is supply the income.
if I can interject quickly.
Well, if I could interject quickly, if you do get it from Amazon, since it's on ebook, there are many devices where the device can read it for you. So if you're on the go or have a long commute, it's a wonderful opportunity to listen to your book
I, for example, have a Kindle reader, so I can just have the Kindle read it to me.
Nice.
Well, that's true. They have some great features. What I'm going for an audiobook is that there's a lot of people who are on the go who listen to audiobooks like to hear a human voice over an electronic one.
Agreed.
So have you written short stories? You've written novels. Have you written short stories, Tim?
Oh, God, yes. Let's see. I've got my first book, The Salvation of Tanglegel, was 12 of my short stories that I had, some of which that I had published over the years. And it's strapped together with a central theme. So you have a central story that's pulling all the other 12 stories together into an ending. And then I've co-written a couple of short stories and got them published with a good writer friend of mine named Neil Reby. He does kaiju stuff a lot. That's Japanese monsters.
Right.
And he's into that circuit. There's a lot of writing there. I've worked with several people collaborating on comic books, which I never got published, unfortunately. So I've been into writing since I was about, I dipped my feet into writing when I was about 16 or 17, and I just haven't stopped since. So.
That's amazing, yeah.
So if you were to look at my first book, which is handwritten on memo pad paper, it just makes me cringe every time I go back and read that one. it's not what you would call educated writing.
So when are you going to write a radio play?
Send me a format and I'll try.
Or adapt one of your stories for radio.
If I could get somebody who could talk me through the format or work with me as far as what the script would look like or how to arrange the script, I'll do it. I'll do anything like that. It doesn't bother me at all.
I'll have to help you with that, Tim, and then maybe we could work on creating that for you.
Oh, sure. That would be good. That'd be cool.
I'd be more than happy to work on any
projects, anybody out there who's listening, any projects that they want to work with as far as my writing goes or any ideas they might have that they just want to talk to me about. I'd be more than happy to talk to anybody about my books or writing or how do you get started writing. Just write me an email or something like that. I'm always open for that sort of thing. The only thing I won't do is give you storylines. That I got to keep for myself, unfortunately.
Oh, that's understandable.
And if most people are afraid to give out their storylines, then if they're looking for advice, as far as I'm concerned, if they want to write me with just general questions of, you know, if you have a general character, how would you set up a general situation for a general character here or this or that, then I'm more than happy to help you with. That way people aren't afraid I'm plagiarizing them or something like that, because that's a big fear out there, too, in the writing community.
Understandable.
Well, I bet pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, we can go ahead and move on to part two of our CBS Radio Mystery Theater offering, The Secret of the Fifth Bell. We'll be back after part two with author Tim Ahrens.
Do you go halfway around the world to help get a job done?
Sweet.
Bonnie Brennan of Brookline, Massachusetts would. Bonnie's a Red Cross volunteer nurse, and she's gone to Thailand to work with medical teams helping Cambodian refugees. And then there's Mary Ann Ryan, who only had to go around the corner to her Red Cross chapter to help. You see, Mary Ann thought no one would want her after she lost her sight 8 years ago. She figured her nursing career was over. But Red Cross knew her experience was too valuable to waste, and we were right. Mary Ann has established prenatal care classes, a blood pressure screening clinic, and mother's aid courses, all for the Red Cross chapter in Doña Ana County, New Mexico. Bonnie and Mary Ann and hundreds of other Red Cross volunteer nurses believe in getting the job done, wherever it is. So if you're interested in nursing and health, they sure could use your help. You don't have to go halfway around the world, but please make the trip around the corner to the Red Cross chapter in your community and help keep Red Cross ready.
There's been a definite change in Frank Phillips in the last month. He's not the freewheeling financier he once was, completely in command of himself, a captain of industries, five-star general of omnipotence. After day, his face is pale, his hands twitch, his eyes roam, and he seems always to be on the alert, listening, waiting. He sends for the one man whose reputation for fathoming the unfathomable is worldwide.
Then, Dearson, I'll pay anything if you can put my mind at rest.
Frank, we went to college together. I turned to solving crimes and you to controlling cartels.
Forgive me, I'm so beside myself with worry. I've forgotten simple courtesy and politeness. How are you? It's been years. Do you keep up with your music?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I still play the violin. Not well, but I finish everything I begin.
That's Van Dusen, all right. In all areas, you were always magnificently thorough.
Well, all right, Frank. What is it that plagues you?
Those bells there, hanging over the west window.
Yes, yes, I was admiring them. Beautiful, beautiful ancient art.
I am always waiting for one of them to ring.
By yourself?
Without anyone touching it or even being near it.
They have rung by themselves?
One of them has. Now, I know it sounds impossible, absurd, but I find I wake up at night trembling, and then I can't get back to sleep. I lie awake for hours waiting. Here, when I'm at work at this desk, as I'm sitting now, I am filled with fear. Even as I talk to you, I'm waiting for that sound. No one hits it. It doesn't even move. A tone just comes out of it.
Now, Frank, you're torturing yourself not because the bell may ring, but because your common sense tells you that the bell cannot and does not make any sound at all. So you have worked yourself into a state and are afraid you may be going mad.
Now, I know that the bell is an inanimate thing, but it acts as if it were alive.
Well, I'll try to help you, Frank. I have a few matters to wind up. I'll be here the day after tomorrow.
You will. I feel so much better now. You were my last hope.
Frank, look up.
Huh?
There's a dead body downstairs in the study, in the room where you work.
What? How do you know?
Well, I went in to open the windows and air the room, just as I do every morning. Oh, Frank, there's blood all over the carpet right under those awful Japanese bells.
Did you call the police?
I didn't know what to do.
Where's Giles?
He hasn't arrived yet.
Giles should be here. He's staying here. I asked him to take a little room off the library because I've been working at night.
Well, then he's not there. I passed it just now. The door's open. There's no one in the room.
Hand me that telephone, Norma. First thing is to call the police.
Ron, didn't you hear me?
Oh, yes. Hello, Mallory. Yes, yes, I heard you.
I've been trying to get you on the phone since noon, Van, but you don't answer it.
I never do while I'm practicing.
Oh, I see. Are you giving a concert?
No, but I may give someone the old heave-ho, even though he is the chief inspector of our renowned Boston police force.
Listen to me. What I need is a combination doctor, medicine man, scientist, practicing psychologist.
In other words, myself.
I haven't finished. And an expert in Oriental art. Shall I go on?
Well, listen. But I make no promises.
This morning, a dead woman was discovered in the house of Frank Phillips.
The dead woman. Not Mrs. Phillips.
Oh, no. So far unidentified.
You do mean the Frank Phillips?
None other.
Well, that's my case. Mrs. Phillips, I'm Dr. Van Dusen. I knew Frank from college. Now, Detective Mallory here asked me to help him on this case. May I talk to your husband?
I'm afraid not. He's in some kind of a shock. We called our doctor, who's given him something to sleep.
Was it you who discovered the unfortunate body?
he was wearing trousers, so I thought first it was a man. But I was told it was a woman. I didn't want to look.
Mrs. Phillips, I'm afraid you'll have to. Everyone in your house will be asked to try to identify the victim.
Did Frank see the victim?
Yes, he did. It was before the police arrived. He bent down. I think he knew who it was.
Well, there's no point in delaying the identification any longer. The boys outside are waiting to remove the remains. Suppose you go in first, ma'am, and then I'll call in the rest of your staff.
It's her. The woman in the antique shop. It's her.
You recognize the victim?
Oh, I'm pretty sure. I saw her only once, but it looks like her.
Her name, Mrs. Phillips. Do you know it?
Elizabeth Wagner. She's German. Bought those bells from her up there. And then she wrote me twice trying to buy them back.
That's interesting. Make you a good offer?
Oh, Frank couldn't let me accept it. He was adamant.
Sounds to me, Van, like they turned out to be a lot more valuable than this Mrs. Wagner originally thought.
Or someone else came to her with a much better offer. Mrs. Phillips, has anyone been a guest here and seen the bells since they were purchased?
Oh, I'm not sure. Yes. There was Mr. Okumatsumi. He's in business with Frank in Tokyo.
And this Mr. Oko Matsumi, did he admire it?
Well, that's what my husband said, Inspector. Offered a fortune to buy it. Frank turned him down flat, too. Inspector, Miss Van Dusen, come over here where I'm standing by the window. Look, down there in the street, right across the way. That's him.
Who?
Mr. Matsumi. He's watching this house. Why is he there? He told Frank he was taking the next plane back to Tokyo. Oh, this is just all too much. Do I have to stay in this room any longer? I feel terribly weak.
No, of course not. Of course not. Here, let me take you to the door. You
Thank
can take
you.
My arm. Here you are. Now, are you sure you can make it to your room all right?
Yes, I can. You're a dear. Frank told me what a good friend you were and how happy he was to see you again. I think I'll just go lie down.
Mallory, is that Japanese still watching this house,
No, he's gone. What do you know about these six bells?
Well, if they aren't from the Horyuju at Nara, I'll eat them.
Is that a famous place?
Unparalleled in Japan. Oh, it's a fabulous monastery built by a Prince Shotoku in 607. And I've got a feeling that those bells belong there.
Ah, stolen.
Give you an idea of their beauty. Now, I'll hit one of them with a pencil. Mallory, on the fifth bell. Look, a smudge of blood.
Hmm? Oh, we're in luck. I'll get this dusted for prints. We just may have our first big lead.
I never did like the morgue in the morning. Identifying cold bodies is a part of a criminologist's job I can do without.
That's true enough for sure. There's a lot of detail to police work that's slightly on the macabre side. Okay, Charlie, you can pull the lady out of the locker. The medical examiner said there was one shot penetrating the skull from the rear. The body must have dropped like a sack of lead.
Whose body?
I thought you'd ask. Now, that's why I'm down here. I had a couple of pigeons stop by just now, and they identified her. Granny Liz, also known as Elizabeth Wagner. Been on the books since I was playing hopscotch. A fence, stolen goods, keeps on the move. 17 Cranston Street was the longest at one address. Insurance companies would call her first. Oh, she made good money in her time.
She won't be making any more.
I'd say she's probably better off where she is. Okay, Charlie, roll her back.
Any leads?
On the perpetrator? I think so. This personal secretary of Phillips named Giles Francis, well, more of an administrative assistant.
Meaning?
He knows everything there is to know about his boss. Now, according to Mrs. Phillips, Francis was living on the premises and hasn't shown up since the morning the body was discovered. Not at his own apartment either. Nowhere. Left his clothes, toothbrush, electric razor, even a billfold with money behind him.
Left in a panic.
He looks like our suspect. We'll get him.
Well, if this lady Frantz was shot through the head and died instantly, she didn't leave her blood on that bill.
But somebody else did. We're still checking for fingerprints.
Frank, I hate to pursue this when you're not feeling well, but the sooner Inspector Mallory and I know everything we can, the sooner we'll get to the end of it. What time did you first see the body?
Well, Norma found it first. I got to it at about 8:30. Right there on the floor where the chalk marks are.
Face down?
I don't remember. I recognized her right away.
Well, you must have turned it over.
I don't know. I don't remember. The window was open, but the door was locked. I saw blood on the fifth bell.
You saw that?
Yeah, it was her blood. I must have fainted. I don't know, when I came to, they'd put me to bed.
Now think back to the first time that bell rang. Do you remember the date?
Remember the date?
Yes.
Well, yes, it was the day after my birthday, Tuesday, the 11th of the month. Norma had just bought me the bells, and the next day I forced the market up to a record price on a whole fleet of container cars I own. I made a bundle. You guys, are you two just going to stand there and keep asking questions?
Now, Frank, to know the facts, we have to ask the questions.
Well, let's come back some other time. I can't talk to you anymore.
Frank, remember, you just said when you first heard the bell ring, for no reason, it was the day after your birthday. And you got a record price for a whole fleet of container railroad cars. Well, that is what I want you to remember about Franklin Phillips. Not being 50 or feeling old or building up some Buddhist bogey. You've got everything to live for, and Inspector Mallory and I will see to it that you do.
A murder committed in a wealthy man's house. Unnerving. More alarming still, the unpredictable tolling of a temple gong. When will it strike next? This unexpected sound challenges understanding, is beyond imagination. We can achieve nothing until we imagine it. And only so far as the human brain can imagine, can it comprehend. I shall return shortly with Act 3.
Hi, I'm Nick, the supermarket manager. Well, now I'm a big TV star. Have you caught me on the tube yet? This customer is asking what she should buy to clean her bathroom. Fantastic, I tell her. And she says...
But Fantastic is my kitchen cleaner. What about my bath?
So I say, look, as fast and easy as Fantastic cleans your kitchen, it'll clean your bath. A couple of days later, she's back all smiles.
Nick, Fantastic is super in the bath.
Fantastic. What it does for your kitchen, it'll do for your bath.
I like pepperoni, but it doesn't like me.
Feel better fast with Digel.
With the ingredients in Digel, relief from acid indigestion and gas starts in less than a minute.
I like corned beef.
I like cabbage.
I like Frank's.
I like beans.
I like spaghetti.
And meatballs.
But they don't like me.
If you like something that doesn't like you,
feel better fast with Digel.
Digel relief starts in less than a minute. Occasional use only as directed.
And that's why we say, go out and buy a bunch today.
And that's your new TV commercial, Mr. Sloak, for Snacky Crackies with Raisin Pits.
How much did that actually cost me?
Cost?
Yes.
Well, we're still adding it all up here. 42,000.
Gee, TV is so expensive.
Not as long as there aren't any changes.
Did I mention there may soon be a worldwide shortage of Raisin Pits?
One TV version without Raisin Pits.
How much will that add to the
3,000.
And we want to tell Health Nuts we make Snackies with Health Nuts.
279,000.
And we need a version that will talk to the financial community.
With the singing mouse and the dancing bunny in a business suit for...
Let me add that one for you. 300,000.
If business conditions make it necessary, with radio you can afford to change commercials fast. If you want to really target consumer groups, it won't cost a fortune to make commercials that fit each audience. Put amazingly flexible radio to work as a primary medium. Radio, it's red hot. For the red hot facts, call this station or the Radio Advertising Bureau. They brought you this message.
We're bringing you Erie House Radio, and we've got our special guest, Tim Ahrens, author of The Grand Game.
And that last commercial reminded me to remind everyone else of the grand question of the day: where's the beef?
Miss Peller, I miss dear old Clara Peller.
There is that commercial came from the two guys that did two of the guys that did Chicken Man. They formed an advertising agency, and Gar is a big fan, and I am too, of Chicken Man. But those two guys, they formed a advertising agency, made more money from that than they ever did from Chicken Man.
Got to go where the cash is.
Yeah.
You were to
following
say
following very much like Bob and Ray did with the soft sell and the silliness of the ads, and they did a whole slew of these that ended up on different mystery theater shows from time to time for Time Magazine and for buying radio spots and things like that. So very, very fun guys.
A lot of that stuff reminds me of what Mel Brooks had to say when he was asked about the movie To Be or Not to Be, his remake of the Jack Benny black and white movie.
Yes.
They asked him why he put comedy. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that particular movie on your program. They probably are. But it's about the Nazi occupation of Germany and some escape of the Jews from there under Nazi oppression. But anyway, they asked him why he put so much humor in such a serious topic of a movie. If you wanted to make a movie about it, why don't you just make a serious movie? And Mel Brooks said, well, that's the point, though. He said, if someone knows they're being taught something, they're going to turn it right off. The thing you have to do is make sure that someone can sit down and be entertained by a movie and not realize they're being taught anything. Then they'll leave the theater questioning everything.
I tried very hard not to like that movie, and I couldn't.
Did you white one with Jack Benny too?
I respected the Jack Benny one. That was a different role for him, and which is why I think I really kind of like that. Most of his movies were not like his persona. He was just acting, and that's why he never was really accepted in movies. But boy, he took radio and television by storm. But yeah, I did see the black and white. I liked that, and that's why I really wanted to not like. As much as I love Mel Brooks, that's why I wanted to not like that movie. But I couldn't help it. I was still like it. It was just Mel Brooks is just a guy you have to love the guy.
Yeah, he had a great
line. He's just
line.
Too good.
Yeah, he had a great line in that movie that you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, because I might be. But I don't believe that the Jack Benny movie had this line in it. But then again, as I said, if you guys could please correct me, that'd be cool. But Mel Brooks had a great line in that movie that summed the whole thing up for writers, people who are trying to get their work done, or actors who are trying to push their craft. He's just escaped Nazi headquarters. He just got his wife out of peril, and he's sitting in his little apartment by himself. He sits down in the chair, and he says, I just gave the greatest performance of my entire life, and no one saw it.
Yeah. I don't think that was in the Benny movie, and that was the only movie I believe that he and his wife did together.
Correct,
Mel Brooks.
They did do a stage performance, a live stage performance.
Yeah.
I saw on, I think it was Showtime or something like that when I was younger. He actually did did that with his wife, and he did a reenacted or recreated the 1 million year old man skit that he did with Caesar.
Yep.
And I'll always remember the joke he used on that show, which is why I remember the show. He's acting as the 1 million-year-old man, and he had the reporter beside him, and the reporter goes, so tell me, how did you live to be 1 million years old? He said, garlic. Garlic is the answer. Every night before I go to bed, I eat 1 pound of garlic. And then when the angel of death taps me on the shoulder, I turn my head and go, yes. Get them every time.
That'll do it.
Yep. Ben Bancroft, who was Mel Brooks' wife, the one vehicle he didn't have any screen time with her, but he was a producer, if not the executive producer, of the vehicle with her, Anthony Hopkins, and it was about, oh, I'm the
was it
Elephant
Magic?
Man.
Oh,
no,
it wasn't, okay.
Elephant
it wasn't
Man.
Magic. Okay.
No, she was an Elephant Man as well as Sir Anthony Hopkins, and he was one of the primary producers of that movie.
Yeah, that was produced under his Brooks Movies or something like that. And
his production company at the time.
His production company, yeah, which he helped a lot of films that would not have otherwise probably made it to film, because that was before the big independent craze away from the studios. And
yeah,
he
when
really
he made,
a lot of films
when he
get
made Blazing, when he made Blazing Saddles, they had that whole scene with the cowboy sitting around the fire, shall we say, flatulating. And he said he was
no, we say
surprised.
Farting here. We say farting here.
Okay, farting.
Oh, Dave, you said the bad
surprised.
Word.
He said he was massively surprised the censors let him get away with that. He thought the censors would shut that right down.
It was too funny. The first time it had ever been done.
Yep.
Another great one, another great piece. I know a lot of, as I said, I know quite a bit of trivia about this stuff. Another great one from him with Blazing Saddles is Trayvon Little. I think I got his name right.
Cleavon Little.
Sorry.
Yeah.
People, when they first saw that movie, I guess, were appalled at some of the things that they were saying to Cleavon Little's character. And who could dare write, you know, lines like that? Richard Pryor wrote most of that script, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's who Mel wanted to star in that role.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
The studio would not buy into that. They just, he was too much of a bad boy, where Cleavon Little was the clean kid, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, he was great for the part anyway. I mean, I give him 100% Cleavon Little. He did a fantastic job in that movie.
He did.
Oh, it was
but
great.
Yeah, I'm big into all that stuff from media. I love Pierce Anthony. I go back to as far as him and his Xanth books are fantastic.
Did he write a foreword for one of your books? Did I see that?
Yes, actually, he did write a foreword for my first book, The Salvation of Tango Gal. Mm-hmm.
How cool is that?
Yeah, I was really floored by it, too. He really liked the book, and he especially liked a couple of short stories I had in there that were near and dear to my heart, one of which was What Big Sisters Do. And that particular short story I wrote in one day. I wrote that one day because I'd heard a report on the news on Thanksgiving morning about some guy. I won't go into details because it's pretty morbid, but some guy didn't think his little girl was worth saving, so he did some mighty bad things to her. And that really upset me, so I went ahead and wrote that all out in a short story, and that's about Jack Simple, who also makes an appearance in the new books, by the way. who is sitting on a park bench considering taking his own life, and a surprising entity shows up to stop him, and that's what's called what Big Sisters Do.
Interesting. You got the wheels going all the time.
Yeah. I can actually, but friends of mine tell me that I can create a character and a rudimentary storyline in under 15 minutes. If you give me an example of what you want, I can create it in under 15 minutes.
Nice.
Three individuals who do old-time radio and have never seen each other.
As I said, I did hear a couple of old-time episodes with one of my favorite actors, Vincent Price. He used to do that stuff.
Mm, yeah, he was a saint. He was a saint on radio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He had such a magnificent voice.
Well, and the fun thing about Vincent Price on The Saint is that he did it, you could tell, like, almost with a smile in his voice. He was having so much fun with that. Because when he wasn't there and Tom Conway filled in with the exact same script, it was not as good a story. Vincent Price elevated the level of that script by what he did and how he presented it.
Yeah, he loved that stuff. I got a short story I can mention about Vincent Price. He did a Canadian TV show, kids show called Castle Frightenstein.
I don't know. I've never heard of this. What is this all about?
Well, what happened was...
Now, Dale.
Oh,
now,
okay. Never mind.
Dale.
Castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him. When next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.
Don't know about this stuff. I apologize.
Never heard of it. We received it here.
You know, Tim,
I lived in Buffalo at the time that was on, and one of the stations we were able to pick up was out of Canada.
Oh,
and
cool.
That aired off the Canadian channel. I was able to watch that when that originally aired.
Oh, cool.
I had to watch the syndicated version.
The producer of that particular show said that they'd had Price come up for a couple of weeks just to do the intros and a lot of the skits, some of the skits, because that's all they could afford. And they thought they were going to have this snooty old actor come up, you know, and have his nose up in the air and stuff like that. And he said when Vincent Price showed up, he said he was nothing but professional. And then whenever they hit lunch between takes, he'd go out and buy a 12-pack of beer, and then he'd sit down and talk to the cast about old Hollywood over beer.
That's wonderful.
Oh, my
and, you know,
gosh.
He did more than that too.
Someone build a time
during
machine. I want to be there.
I know.
Yeah. During the show, he also did little short poems during the show as well. So that was one of the things that he did on that show as well. But whatever Vincent touched, it was just marvelous.
Absolutely.
I agree. I think he did a fantastic job with whatever he did. Even when he got older and even with Edward Scissorhands, we didn't have any lines, he still did a beautiful job.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was truly a swan song movie.
It was.
Yeah.
That was very good of
Tim Burton
to do that.
Tim Burton.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess he's as big a fan of Vincent Price as I am, or a lot of other people are. So I guess he was floored when Price said he'd actually do the film.
Well, that was the one movie that Vincent and his daughter both appeared in, I guess.
Oh, that's right.
Oh yeah,
Victoria.
Right. Yeah.
In there, fantastic! I have to look that up again.
Well, I'm a member of the.
She brought that
Price
up when she came
club.
To Glardy Fest. She,
yeah, I'm a
she
member
brought
of the
that
Vincent
up when
Price.
She came to
oh,
Fest.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I'm a member of the Vincent Price fan club on Facebook, and she's always posting on that. So that's how I know about some of this stuff. And she has
we should send you a link to an old show, Dave. We recorded a when she went to Glardy Fest and talked a great deal with great affection about her dad and just shared some amazing stories.
And from what I understand, not quite so great affection about, was her second mom or her third mom, something like that.
Yeah, that wasn't so well, but.
Oh, you mean Coral Brown.
Yeah, I don't think she made very well with that particular.
Yeah, I don't think Vincent didn't remember her with a great deal of esteem either, considering the fact that he had no idea that when she passed away, she was worth over $6 million.
Yeah, it would have been a surprise.
Especially since she was penny pinching all the time.
But, you know, going back just for actors and older actors in general, I still say that, in my own personal opinion, some of the older actors had more class than some of the newer ones. Another good example would be Boris Karloff, which I always adore in Black and White.
Yeah,
a gentleman's gentleman.
Yep.
A gentleman.
There's a story about when he made Frankenstein. which you guys probably already heard, but in case you didn't, where the little actress was, they were filming by the pool where you're supposed to throw the actress in, you know, the little girl with Frankenstein was, and they were going to cut for lunch. And so the producer, I think it was White, I forget what his first name was.
You're thinking of James Whale.
James Whale, thank you. You're right, not White. Asked her who she wanted to drive to lunch with, and she ran up to Boris Karloff in full makeup and said she wanted to ride with a monster. And I guess Karloff leaned down and said, "I would give me nothing but great pleasure to ride with you."
and you could just hear it in that kindly voice that he had. I mean, he can sound sinister as anything, but he also had a kindly edge to his speech that often kids were attracted to him and saw through the monster.
And he was extremely proud of that, too. He didn't want to do Bride of Frankenstein originally because it broke the mystique and made him talk or let him talk. But originally, after he got the script and started doing the Bride of Frankenstein, he relented and said, no, it was a good idea. But then when they proceeded to do more movies with the monster, he refused to do the monster after the Return of Frankenstein, I think it was, or Son of Frankenstein.
Son of Frankenstein, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of what they were doing.
It was a horror on his body. I mean, he was a young man when he did Frankenstein, but what that did to his body, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Actually, James Whale, some have said that he was brutal to Karloff because Whale directed both the first one and Bride.
Mm-hmm.
And would deliberately make him do stuff over and over and extreme, you know, physical challenges, wearing all that makeup and all the... that was heavy stuff, very heavy.
Yeah, back then they didn't have the CG ability we have these days. I'm trying to think of the guy who did Baron Frankenstein. It was the actor was come on, Tim.
Colin Clive.
There we go. Well, Colin Fry was actually Igor.
No, Colin Clive. Colin
Clive. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah,
Clive.
Doctor. There we go.
Like Doctor Who, he was the first Doctor.
Yeah. That surprises me that the Whale was so hard on Karloff, because in Bride of Frankenstein, the reason why Clive was sitting so much in the first part of the film is because he had broken his leg a week before they started the film, because he was a little into his cups and he had fallen down a flight of stairs or something like that and broke his leg.
Ouch.
So he couldn't walk.
Ew.
Sounds like alcohol related to me, but hey,
it
you
was.
Know.
Since he was so hard on Karloff, it surprised me that he wasn't harder on that particular actor too, because that's why in Bride of Frankenstein, when they go, you know, back to his character, he's laying in bed for the first scenes, where he's sitting down talking to I'm not going to munch his name, so the other professor who does another fantastic job in that film.
Oh, in Bride, you mean?
Yeah, Bride. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's his name? Ernest Thysinger. Ernest Thysinger.
Yeah, Pretorius,
Pretorius, yeah.
I swear, he holds his own throughout that entire picture. I think he's better than Clive was in that picture. I think he just comes forward 100%. I wish he'd done more.
If you like him, I also recommend, and it's another James Whale directed film, that also features Karloff, Old Dark House.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, and Charles Lofton's in it, too. That's right. I forgot.
Oh, this is another great... It's just going back to old actors, it just seems to me that they had a lot more respect for their genre or themselves or the people they were working with, to the point where they wouldn't just come out and trash them for anything. Or, you know, it was always a professional respect between the actors. In my opinion, mind you.
More respect from the actors than it was from the studios, because the studios treated their actors like absolute crud.
Oh, no, yeah, I've heard that, yeah. But, I just thought that I'd put that out there, because I'm a big old movie buff, if you couldn't tell, which you probably could.
with that being said, and to your point, if I can find it here, Bear with me just a moment.
Mm-hmm. He's scrolling. Scrolling.
I'm not scrolling. I'm leafing through pages.
Opens his old tomes and looks through great literature.
You hit the nail on the head. This is from Famous Monsters of Filmland, issue 116, from May of 1975. If I may, I think we have time and still can finish out our radio program. It's a brief note from Lon Chaney Jr. It isn't easy to write about your father who is dead, especially when that father happened to once personify all the fiendish attributes in the world to 7 million of his countrymen. But so many of his friends have spoken to me since his death, those friends he never knew, asking what he was really like. Only the other day I received a letter from a lady in Mobile, Alabama, who had seen every Lon Chaney picture and wanted to know whether I was related to him. Strangely enough, those friends remember him not as the unspeakable Phantom of the Opera, nor even as the deformed but heroic little man who poured boiling oil on the attackers of Notre Dame, but rather as a superbly gifted and incomparably versatile player who could be all things in all pictures. I can't blame them for their curiosity, and I feel it is only fair to his memory to tell what the man of a thousand faces looked like to his son. My father was a kind man. Perhaps through overuse, that word has lost something of its pristine strength. We've only come to think of a kind man as one who helps elderly ladies across the street and gives coins to beggars. My father was kind in a deeper sense than that. This is really to your point here, this part, Tim. He loved people and he knew how to please them. Nothing gave him greater joy than helping other people along, whether they were lifelong friends or chance acquaintances. And I don't mean merely assisting them financially or getting jobs through them. Through heaven knows he was generosity itself in those respects. He gave unflaggingly of the far more precious gifts of sympathy and understanding. Even at the height of his fame, he was still preserved his sincere and democratic attitude toward all persons with whom he came in contact. Success failed to destroy his standard of values. There was no time when he felt that he was too great to listen to the troubles of the lowest stagehand or give a kind word and a helping hand to a struggling extra. At the same time, with his other lack of affectation, he had the same kindly interest in the less poignant troubles of the greatest stars and was constantly the confidant of Hollywood's biggest names. In later years, when the whole world knew him and wondered what he was like, he would spend hours talking to some beggar who had approached him for a handout and who frequently found himself, to his own immeasurable surprise, the recipient of a staggering, munificent sum. And the friends of his trooping days, how he enjoyed chatting with them when they came to see him. No former fellow players were ever turned away from the lot on which Lon Chaney was working. He saw them all, talked to them all, and somehow found means to help many of them on their way to belated success. As for my own view of him, that is a matter of which I could never write calmly or dispassionately. Lon Chaney was always, for me, the greatest of all heroes, the personification of all that was fine and true. He was my father. I was going to save that for Father's Day, but since you brought that up about the respect that
If we have a second, I do have a story about Creighton Chaney, which is Lon Chaney Jr.
Right.
I guess it did crush him quite a bit when Universal, I do believe, decided to remake the Phantom of the Opera, and they chose Claude Rains over him. He tried his best to get that part, and they didn't think he was good enough for it. And I think it just crushed him that he couldn't redo his father's part.
Wow,
that's too bad because
he
came into his own as the Wolfman, but also in Man Made Monster and as Karras.
Although, in my opinion, one of his best roles is of Mice and Men.
Oh, yes, Lenny.
I'm with you.
Yep.
As Lenny.
Which he even parodied in that Bob Hope movie, My Favorite Brunette. He parodied that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. I saw that one too. That was great. I can keep going. I don't want to hold up your radio program, though.
Oh, no. We're having a blast talking to you. We got plenty
segment.
Of time.
Okay, good. All right.
Absolutely. It's been a treat having a conversation with you.
Yeah. We hope you're enjoying your time with us as much as we are with you.
Oh, Oh, God, yes. If you can't hear it, my voice, you're tone deaf. I love talking about people, talking with people who share my passions or share passions in general of this sort of stuff. You can ask some of my closest friends, and they'll tell you that I could spend, which I won't, but I could spend an hour and a half talking about nothing but Rod Serling, for instance, which is what I almost did in your last program, so I apologize.
Oh, that's all right.
We're going to get a Rod Serling expert in here, and along with that, a 1953 radio play that he wrote and produced in Cincinnati. So we're going to get that, and we'll have to let you know when that's going to be on.
Yeah, because he's I know an awful lot about Rod Serling. Plus, I also am a member of his daughter's fan page on Facebook, and I've got all 156 episodes of his Twilight Zone show. I know he did some stuff before that in Playhouse Theater. I know that Rod Serling's Twilight Zone would have never gone off the ground without Lucille Ball.
Or Desi Arnaz. Yeah,
and Desi Arnaz. Although Lucille Ball was the driving force behind Desi Lu Productions.
Well, leave it to Dave to find us some radio stuff that we can use here with Rod Serling.
Yeah,
well,
she also saved Star Trek, which was going to go down in flames with Gene Roddenberry.
She did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a lot of people don't know that. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that Lucille Ball was quite a mover and a shaker when it came to production, about putting things into production.
Oh yeah, she was a tough negotiator too, and a strong business person.
Otherwise, besides that, I know a lot about that. I know I've always been in love with Outer Limits. I know quite a bit about that. Like for instance, they had each one of those half-an-hour episodes, they had to write in 6 days. That is, write, produce, film, direct, and get it out in 6 days. So the writers
actually
had to
come up with
the script. Yep.
The Outer Limits?
The writers had,
And those were one-hour shows. Yeah.
Were they? I thought they were half-an-hour shows.
Yep.
No, Outer Limits was a full hour.
For the most part, was...
Okay.
Yeah, that was a full hour.
You're right. I'm thinking of The Inheritors as being... It's the only two-parter they showed, so that's why I was always thinking about half-an-hour shows. But.
Yeah. And that was,
so what is this show you were talking about?
I actually have
never,
a soundtrack to
never
that
heard
series.
It.
So can you guys tell me which your favorite episodes of that particular series are?
I have favorites. I have many favorites.
Yeah.
My all-time favorite's always... Oh, go ahead.
Demon with the glass hand.
Is that your favorite?
That is one of my favorites. Demon with the glass hand and the sixth finger.
Oh, yeah,
your ignorance makes me ill and angry. That's the
angry.
Funniest line I've ever heard in a Outer Limits, rather.
I think one that terrified me the most was Cry in the Night.
Oh,
Eddie
that
Albert.
Was a good one.
Oh, yeah. That one got a lot of play. For some reason, I must have saw that one particular episode like 20 times. But that one I found very frightening as a kid.
Considering that there was no monster at all that anybody could see.
One that scared a good friend of mine, was Nightmare.
Nightmare is good.
But my all-time favorite is always going to be... Okay.
Zandy Misfit.
My all-time favorite is always going to be The Inheritors. It's always going to be my all-time favorite.
That one's a tearjerker.
That was an interesting... Yeah, that really was an interesting story. That merited two episodes, two parts.
Oh, it definitely did. I agree. And they had some really great actors to play the parts. Then I know there's some people have argued with me about the ending as to whether the aliens were telling the truth or not. That's left up to conjecture. But I just like the sentiment that goes into the end of that particular episode. That, you know, somewhere out in space, it doesn't always have to be evil, horrible aliens that are about to kill you or attack the planet. There can be some good things out there.
And I learned that in another Outer Limits at a very early age with Behold Eck is one of my favorites.
Oh, yes. I remember that one, too, with the eye doctor.
Yeah. And Eck, you know, he was causing damage, but he wasn't doing it deliberately. He was from another dimension and had little issues getting out of here.
So yeah, they had a, I'm really impressed with how fast those writers came up with those scripts, and then they got them filmed just as quickly. And it turned out as well as it did, considering they had such little time to do it in.
And they were making up special effects along the way, because at that point there really wasn't many television special effects.
Oh, and I agree. And then they got some great actors like Donald Pleasance with they did The Man with the Power. That's another one of my favorites.
Yep, that's a goodie.
I love that last line of his, like, if I have this kind of power, then I no longer wish to live, because he couldn't control it anymore.
Yeah.
And I always thought that might have, this might predated or expedited, but I always thought that, you know, well, Forbidden Planet was a lot like that, is your sub, what would happen if your subconscious became the dominant? This is so much more powerful than your conscious mind that it was actually taking control of things that you were aware of, but couldn't do anything to stop it.
Yeah,
that's a really scary thought.
The id.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many great actors. I'm thinking of Robert Culp and David McCallum, and boy, just so many. William Shatner.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
so
of the
actors.
Star Trek people were in there, because I know Scotty was. Takai was
Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy
was in the original iRobot.
Yep.
Leonard Nimoy was in the original iRobot, yeah.
In fact, if you since you guys are aficionados of Twilight Zone, if you go back to, I do believe the episode is Eye of the Beholder, it's where they have a bunch of Japanese trapped in a cave, and
yes,
this is during World War II.
Yep.
If you look back to the right, he only has one line. One of the soldiers on the right is Leonard Nimoy. He only has one line.
I'll be darned. Hey, let's wrap up our radio program. We'll have a little bit more chance to talk before the end of the show, and if you want to stick around, Tim, even after the show. Records for a little while afterwards. But let's wrap up The Secret of the Fifth Bell and find out how this wraps up from CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
This is what we know. Without warning, an ancient Japanese bell peals day or night in the house of Franklin Phillips. There has been a murder of a woman with a criminal record. The young executive secretary to Phillips has disappeared, and the financier himself, haunted by the bell that feeds on his fears, is gradually losing control of himself, is close to the edge of madness.
Can't you two understand how I feel? I must know what it is that makes the bell toll when it does. Have they located Giles Francis yet?
No, not yet, but they will. You'd given him a gun, Frank, hadn't you?
Of course. There's always the chance of a burglar plenty to steal in this house. And Giles was an excellent shot, too.
You're implying...
Nothing at all. Draw your own conclusions.
Yes. Well, one last question, Frank. This Mr. Oku Matsumi from Japan. Have you ever met him before?
No, not in person. He wired me from Tokyo. He was on his way. Why? What are you getting at?
Well, I'm only trying to ascertain whether he was Oku Matsumi or not.
I never asked to see his passport. I feel trapped. No getting away, hemmed in by all this. And I can't reason it out. In a swamp of fog.
Well, to me, Frank, it's all quite clear. One vital point needs answering. Once done, that'll be it.
You've a solution?
Depending on the answer. If it's affirmative, I know that an Oriental mind, such as a Japanese, could have conceived this affair. The answer is negative. Well, then the entire matter becomes ridiculously simple.
Van Dusen, where have you been?
Making inquiries, Inspector.
Oh, I know that. One of my men tells me you entered the hotel opposite the Phillips Mansion, that you went to the rear of the second floor at the end of a hall and looked out of a large plate glass window overlooking the city. And then you walked to the other end of the hall and stood staring out at the Phillips place across the street.
Well, I don't know why you bother asking me when your men are so observant.
We know where you went, but not why.
Mallory, I've written here a list of information I'll need urgently. Now, I'm due back at Frank Phillips, so I must go.
Hold on a minute. Give me a chance to look at these questions of yours. Was there a storm the midnight before finding the body? Direction and velocity of the wind. Get complete local weather report for tonight. What is all this? What's it got to do with the murder and the ringing bell?
Everything, Inspector.
Uh-huh. Oh, by the way, I've got bad news for you. That fingerprint or prints? Too smudged for identification.
Yes, well, I was afraid that would be the case. Now, as soon as you get that meteorological information, bring it to me at Phillips, will you?
Are you going straight back there?
No, I'm stopping off at my place first, picking up my violin and a champagne glass.
Mr. Mitsumi, what a surprise. Mrs. Hansen said you were downstairs and wished to see me.
Yes, the Honorable Madame.
I thought you were leaving for Tokyo days ago.
Unexpected developments compared my remaining in your fair city. How is your husband? Well, I trust?
Well, he would have come down himself to greet you, but he has not been well lately.
Ah, so. The bells have rung?
What made you say that?
Mrs. Phillips, the power of our ancient ceremonies transcend the ages. A man of such resources as Mr. Phillips must have realized America is not the proper home for those bells.
Oh, I don't agree. Museums and private collectors the world over have artifacts from ancient Egypt, China, ancient Rome.
Forgive me. Those are dead objects, Mrs. Phillips. These ancient temple bells are alive.
You frighten me.
I have no desire to do so. I hope my warning comes not too late. This envelope is for Mr. Phillips. When he has recovered, insist that he read it. Good day, Mrs. Phillips.
And as soon as he handed me this envelope, Dr. Van Dusen, he disappeared.
May I take charge of the letter?
Oh, yes. Here. What does it mean? What's written on the outside?
Well, just what it says, Norma. To be opened when the fifth bell rings 11 times. For the present, I'll hang on to it. I don't want to add another worry to Frank right now.
No, he is better, though.
Then, do you think he could be persuaded to come down to the study?
I think so. I know he always feels more secure when he sees you.
Well, it's good to see you, Frank.
It's good to be on my feet. I think I've shaken that weak feeling.
Yes. Well, I think I can make this fast, Frank. Logic always works fast. It's the sum total of fact as inevitable as two and two making four.
Excuse me. Hello? Who do you want to talk to? Oh, yes. Yes, he's here. It's for you, Dr. Van Dusen.
Oh, thank you. Van Dusen here. Oh, he's on his way, eh? Right. Thank you. Well, the weather tonight, light wind from the east, 4 miles an hour. Norma, Frank, in 2 minutes, 15 seconds from now, that fifth bell will sound 10 times. A woman was shot here. A bloody fingerprint left on that bell, a door locked from the inside, the east window open. Giles Francis is missing. That much we know. Yet no one heard a revolver go off. It was thundering that night. Possible explanation. Why did the curio dealer sneak into the house? It was obviously to steal what she couldn't buy back. There's 1 minute and 5 seconds and the bell will ring. But to come back to that night, a shot fired. Moments later, the bell starts to ring. Must have been nerve-wracking, terrifying. blood on his hand from trying to see who the prowler was. The person with the gun runs to the bell and tries to stop its sound, and then he runs out.
Not a bad theory, Van, but it's not fact.
Oh, well, I didn't hear you come in, Mallory.
Well, I brought with me a friend of Mr. Phillips. Oh, perhaps not a friend anymore, but a former employee. Giles Francis, would you step forward?
Well, what are you doing here? Giles, you promised that...
Yes, I had to come back. I didn't shoot anyone that night. It was him.
You, Frank!
My property. She wants to steal it. Man's house is his castle. Common burglar. Yes, I shot her.
There goes the bell on the button.
It knows. It hears me. It's alive. Norma, help me up. I've got to stop its ringing. What are you looking at me for? I didn't know who it was. I got them with one shot, and then I turned the body over, you see? Who was it? Who would come here? And then the bell started tolling like John Donne says. It tolled for me. I couldn't stand it. I grabbed it. I held on to it. I couldn't make it stop ringing until it wanted to stop.
All right now, Mr. Phillips, would you just come over here with me for a moment? I want you to calm down.
Frank is in a terrible state, Dr. Van Dusen, and you can see for yourself.
Well, I think I can convince him, if he'll let me, that there is nothing to fear.
What about that note from the Japanese? To be opened when the bell rang 11 times.
Oh, that's hogwash, Norma. There are natural explanations for the occasional ringing.
What are you two whispering about?
Frank. Frank, listen. The ringing of the bell at any time is a purely physical phenomenon.
They're after me. They want it back in the Temple of Buddha. Over my dead body, they'll get it.
Frank, that is nonsense. Do you know what activates the fifth bell? Vibration. Sound waves. Where does it come from? The town hall clock half a mile away. Now the sound travels through the second floor hall of the hotel across the street, through your east window, and activates the fifth bell. It's like a tuning fork.
But why not all the time? Why only sometimes?
Well, a gust of air, even a person walking through the hotel can interrupt the vibration.
No, that is... That isn't so.
Oh, Frank! His baby.
Well, he's overwrought, Norma. You know, killing someone, even a robber, their blood on your hands, it's traumatic. Now, on top of that, he's so convinced an evil spirit of some ancient rite is out to get him, so he just isn't prepared to accept the truth. Now, you call the doctor immediately. Well, what did the doctor say just now before he left?
He said not to worry.
Well, Norma, I'm packing it in. That's enough for one day. I'll take my violin and go.
I meant to ask you why you brought it. Oh, excuse me. At night, if it's late and someone comes to the door, the butler sounds a buzzer. We don't generally admit anyone after 10. I'll just pick up the wall phone. Yes, who is it?
It's Inspector Mallory, Mrs. Phillips. I know it's late, but may I speak with you a moment?
Oh, well, certainly. Meet us in the study. You know the way. That was Inspector Mallory. Shall we go down? Welcome back, Inspector.
Well, now, I hope you'll forgive me. I had an idea, and so to test it, I wanted to have another look at that fifth bell. You see, that circle with the three dots inside and the three rays. I think it has a meaning.
Yes, it probably does, but that's not the reason it keeps ringing. I thought I proved it to you.
Oh, not to me, Van. The idea of a vibration leaving a town hall clock a half a mile away, running the length of a hotel hall, and then jumping across the street to get this bell to ring. No, it could never happen. No vibrations have that power.
Well, Norma, with your permission, I'd like to give you all a little private concert. Now, excuse me while I open my violin case.
Now, we will begin tonight's concert by tapping the edge of this champagne glass. Now, taking up my violin, I will try to play the same tone sung to us by the glass. Norma, please take this glass and place it on the mantelpiece. Thank you. Now, I draw my bow across the violin strings at the same pitch as the champagne glass. There. The glass shatters across the room. Vibrations. Not powerful enough, eh, Inspector? It works just as well half a mile away as inside this room, and you don't need a Stradivarius to prove it. Welcome, Inspector. You're just in time for the Allegro movement.
No, I haven't time for that, Van Dusen.
Yes, well, I know what that means. Problems.
Yes, unfortunately.
I thought Frank gave you a statement, and in view of shooting a prowler and so on, you dropped any conspiracy charges.
We did. But I learned today from Mr. Phillips that you had a note to be given to Phillips.
A note? Oh, note, yes, yes.
From that Doku Matsumi.
It said that when the bell rang 11 times, that was the end of Phillips, or words to that effect. I mean, I'm sorry, I threw it away. It's just superstitious rot.
Man, listen to me. Yesterday was the 11th day since Frank Phillips tried to stop bell from ringing 11 times. Well, this morning he's dead. His wife called me. I brought along the medical examiner, and he had a look at him.
Oh, dear. Poor man. Heart failure, I suppose.
I don't believe that. His heart stopped, all right. But not from natural causes.
Oh, come on now. The man was on the edge of a total breakdown.
And do you remember the markings on that fifth bell? A circle with three dots and three rays extending from it? I saw those same marks on Philip's forehead.
So much for the principles Professor Van Dusen lives by, a belief that imagination is essential to solve any given problem, that all material problems can be solved, and that in meeting them, logic is the lever. I think perhaps our crime-solving friend won't be as inflexible in the future, don't you? I shall return shortly. Your Lung Association and you know that cigarettes are a breathing hazard. Smokers, please don't add that extra offense. Give us a break for life and breath.
Fake news.
We live in an age when the incredible no longer surprises us. We can accept today what yesterday would have been laughed at, and the day before would have caused us torture at the stake. Our premise on Mystery Theater is not only to open a confounding world to your dial, but to open your mind to the scientific acknowledgement that there is no such thing as the impossible. Or as Napoleon once said in another context, impossible? There's no such word in French. Our cast included Earl Hammond, Arnold Moss, Joyce Gordon, and Ian Martin. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown. And now,
a preview of our next tale.
Did you say Morley?
Mr. Morley Norcross. He's sitting in the garden by the fountain.
There's no one sitting in the garden, Miss Phillips.
No one? Why, he's gone. And the door's locked.
Of course.
Why are you looking at me like that, Mrs. Broly?
Miss Phillips, finding this key put a very old woman to considerable trouble. Now, I don't mind that. I'm accustomed to it and delighted to make my tenants as comfortable as possible. But I don't like having games played on me, Miss Phillips. I don't enjoy being made a fool of.
Mrs. E.G. Marshall inviting you to return to our Mystery Theater for another adventure in the macabre. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
Macabre.
Macabre. That wraps up Secret of the Fifth Bell from CBS Radio.
Which, of course, they never answered.
No, they never did. Well, we're going to really be...
Go ahead.
Oh, just real quick. We got about maybe 4 minutes left. Next week on Eerie House Radio, we're really bombing it. Yeah, it's an explosive show with suspense, Richard Diamond, and High Adventure. And then there'll be a bomb on board with CBS Radio Mystery Theater again next Saturday, Deadly Dilemma. Set your calendar. Time is ticking.
Yep, High Adventure is another one of those exciting stories coming to us from South Africa.
Yeah.
Highly recommended.
Yep. Yeah, Dave found us a bunch of stuff there. But
even Doc Sampson would enjoy it.
Yep. So besides the Book of Facing on the internet, are there other places people can connect to or see your work online?
Yes, you can see all my prior work except for the new book, which hasn't been added to my website yet, at www.thedarkcreatures.com.
Dark Creatures. Get into that world you've created. See, I love the maps, too, that CW pointed out earlier. Tolkien did it. Michael Moorcock did. I think even there were a lot of maps for Robert E. Howard's world. I think that's a great way to build.
It's a great
build.
Tool, yeah.
Yeah.
It's another great nod to James Reich, who does my interior work artwork, because all I did was give him a description of what Poulenc or Laguerre looked like. He actually did the work with his own imagination, so he's very versatile.
Gotta love that. And Dave, what do you got?
What have I got? I don't have a whole lot. Weirdness, Really Bad Movie will need not this Tuesday, but the following Tuesday. And we'll be showing and sharing and chatting along with the Kennel Murder Case.
Ooh. In case you guys are interested, if you've seen it on Facebook, I guess they are releasing the 1983 The Thing in the theaters again sometime in mid-June, I think June or July.
Ooh.
So if no one's seen that in the big screen, which I actually got a chance to see in the drive-in when I was younger... You should actually see
it.
It's definitely worth it.
Is it the original or the John Carpenter The Thing?
It's the John Carpenter one. In my opinion, of his greatest films.
Yeah.
I guess it was also one of his most horrific films to direct. I guess they had all sorts of problems on that set.
One of the best films to use practical effects rather than...
True.
other types. Very well done. Very, very well done.
Genius. Yeah, I mean, there are still people who quote lines from that film.
Yes.
For a real life sleeper, Giles.
Well, Tim, if you'd like to stick around with us, we're going to lose the live audience. Thank you very much, Fogsbane, for sticking through with us. And good old Bob took off a little bit earlier in the chat, plus those folks we can't see that are listening. Stick around.
I would also like to thank you all for joining me. I hope you enjoy the book if you buy it, or at least enjoy looking at it. I would definitely appreciate it.
Yep. Everyone buy a copy. Buy two. Give one to a friend.
I need
it. Absolutely.
No formal ending tonight. Close. Thanks, live audience. Bye-bye. There we go. We're still being recorded.
Boy, that
so we
went right out.
It jumped right out of there. But
the 83 version of the thing. I like the black and white too. That's a lot of fun too. It's it's much more mysterious in my opinion than John Carpenter's version. John Carpenter's version is more of a monster movie. That's of course my opinion. But either way, both films are well done. They grab you from the beginning to the end. It's really quite good. In fact, if I remember my father saying that he saw the original black and white in the theaters, that it scared the hell out of him as a kid.
by the way, Tim, Fogsbane left a note on his way out saying that he bought your last two and he will buy this one as well. So.
Well, cool. Thank you. Thank him. Thank you very much.
Oh, my gosh. He's an insanely cool guy, Fogsbane. You have no idea.
I appreciate it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we are blessed with the greatest listeners on earth and participants like CW and Gar.
My greatest joy in writing isn't necessarily making huge amounts of money with a book. I'd like to, but it's not my greatest joy. My greatest joy is watching people read it or having people get back to me about what they liked about it or even what they disliked about it. Engaging people with writing is one of my favorite things to do. Or talking to people about it, as you can tell, about stuff like that. It's just one of my ultimate favorite things to do. That's why I do it.
One of our favorite things to do is get great guests like yourself. We'd love to have you back again and again.
I'd love to come back whenever you have time or the opportunity. I'd be more than happy to. Yeah,
you
guys are fantastic.
You don't have to. You don't have to wait for an invite, Tim. You can call up.
Oh.
And just be part of the show like that.
Oh. Okie dokie.
It is.
If you guys
possible to call up without having to be scheduled in. If we hit a topic or something you're enjoying, for a particular actor or something, call up and chime in.
Okay, I will. If you guys are still...
What he's trying to say is open invite.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. You guys are fantastic, too. In fact, as I said, I've recommended you to quite a few people, and I still push you on my Facebook pages whenever you guys pop up.
Thank you. And feel free to post on the Eerie House pages anytime you have products, books, or whatever. You're into some really cool stuff, so we love it.
Yeah, I love that stuff, too. Trust me, I'm a nutso fan. I've lost my thought. Never mind. We'll move on. Some writer I am.
Well, it's a great, real treat to speak to the author of a book. It is.
I love feedback. I love people who are interested in the same thing I am. As I said, I enjoy, for instance, I would be more than happy rather than watching TV. I'm one of these people who, during a cookout, for instance, would love to sit around with a bunch of people and just shoot the shit. I love that sort of stuff because you never know what someone's going to say or what they're going to bring up.
And I understand what you say when you're watching people. Watch, you know, when I'm doing, you know, showing off the skits or something like that, I'm not watching the skit. I'm watching the people watch my skit and seeing their reactions to what's going on. I know exactly what you're talking about with that.
That's the funnest part about it for me is watching people discover something. For instance, in Tanglegal, in Salvation Tanglegal, those short stories all have deeper intermeetings here and there and left and right, especially, you know, the one I mentioned on What Big Sisters Do. And I love it, seeing the light go on in people's faces when they find it. it's just great.
One of the things that I love about doing a show live like this, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do podcasts. We could probably do this cheaper, and it would probably sound a lot cleaner when we're done with it. But there's something about that live thing where you get feedback from people, whether it's their interest in the chat, or if we're lucky to have them call us, like CW was a listener caller, and then now she's part of the family here.
She is, yep. And she adds so much to what we do because she is so well read and knows so much about movies and television and all that, that she can add so much to what we do. And plus, she tries to keep Dale and I in line.
And it's so much more fun to hear somebody talk with a passion in their voice than to hear not to hear it. Someone can talk analytically, and it's a good, give a good diet, you know, a good try, diet try, but it's going to be boring if you don't hear the passion of their voice about it.
True enough.
Well, thank you. I think I'm a very passionate soul myself, but that's just me talking.
I agree. You know quite a bit, and I bow my greater will to you.
We're not worthy.
Bow down, underlings. Bow down.
But that's why I called you guys to see if you were interested again in my second book, because I just loved being on your show. But I'll be paying more attention to being able to call in and stuff like that from now on. I just love talking to you guys. You're great.
Well, yeah. Plus, you know, when we come up with a particular topic or an actor that's in there, you know, you'll have a little different view of it than the rest of us had, and it always gets to throw some extra things out there for our listeners as well as for us.
Yeah, facts, pieces of information. Everybody here loves sharing the old, information about the things we grew up with, the radio, the television.
Yeah, friends, I could hardly believe, getting back to Vincent Price shortly for a short moment, I could hardly believe that almost nobody I talked to at work who was under the age of 30 to remember Vincent Price in Laura. In fact, they don't even know what Laura was.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And no, he was very prominent in that film. He wasn't always a horror actor. And there's a lot of people who just don't realize that.
No, he was kind of a creepy character in that one. But
yeah.
I can kind of understand that, because right now we're in the phenomenon of where Hallyu, which is Korean, not just Korean pop, but also Korean style of anime, and anime in and of itself is really, really taking over, especially the Hallyu. For example, the movie Parasite,
which is fantastic.
It won an Oscar. Parasite, a South Korea foreign film that was praised so highly. If you ask people about that, they're going to know that.
In fact, it's interesting to note that a lot of people don't realize that Japan is actually shipping more of their animation over to Korea now and doing less of it themselves.
I didn't know
The American approach. Outsource it.
Yeah, I'm not. I really kind of feel sorry for some of the animators in Japan. I've heard some stories about what they go through, and although their product is fantastic, I guess most of the money that comes off of those shows from Western, like Crunchyroll or Funimation or something like that, most of that cash goes to either director or the company or the voice actors. The actual animators get paid very little.
That's a shame.
Yes, it is. I mean, some of the black companies over there, I guess, are ghastly as far as working their people to the point where, you know, they're working 18 hours. They got to sleep in their office.
Wow.
But we'll get off the really bad, sorry, conversation.
It comes up.
Okay.
Oh, part of the fun.
If you are interested in looking at my shorts, any of my short story work, or the bulk of it, which was in my first book, for a radio possibility, I can just send you a book. That's entirely up to you, of course. But
I would love to have a copy of one of your books.
Sure. Send me your addresses. Do you want me to send it to? I've got 5 copies left of Tanglegel that I can send out, 5 author copies here. If you want to send me some addresses that you want me to send it to,
sure.
I'd be more than happy to ship it out to you.
Sure,
I'll go ahead and put that in your Facebook message
yep.
to you, Tim.
Oh, sure. Sounds good.
As will I. Whoa, that's awesome.
I look forward to the other.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd love you to ship to the other 2 books, but I just ran out of author copies.
If you could, of course, sign it, that would be wonderful, too.
Oh, sure. No problem. Thank you for asking.
Same.
Gentlemen, I must break it up. I must be away. Mr. Ahearns, it was just a sheer delight having a chat with you. And as Dale and Dave said, please don't be a stranger. I'd love to have another conversation with you about your characters, your books, etc. But I'm on the road, so I really have to choose.
Okay.
All right. Be safe out there on their roads.
Don't worry. Just worry for everyone else on the highway. I'm coming.
You don't drive a hearse. Remember the CW. If you must drink and drive, please use your car.
You don't drive a hearse for any chance, do you?
Actually, I was thinking of getting the vehicle. Getting the vehicle painted a nice Munster's black, the realm of possibility. But again,
I was thinking
everyone,
of Phantasm.
Oh, yes. Yes. I would love to get one of those spheres and be able to throw it across the room. Pay attention. Boom.
Yeah.
That would be bouncing off of my head. I can just tell.
Have a good one, everyone. See you next time.
Yep. Have a good night.
CW.
Bye, CW. She's awesome.
Talking about vehicles, another that brings up another great subject is it's well known now. I guess it's not shown very often anymore. It's called The Car.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah.
I have that on DVD.
My favorite quote? Cat poo! Remember the old lady in the cemetery?
Yeah.
Shaking her fist? Cat poo! She really told off that evil car. No, but what, James Brolin's in that one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's a good trivia question for anybody who's seen that film or you guys too. At the end, when it goes off the cliff with the TNT and stuff.
Yeah.
What do you guys see in the fire?
There's a face.
People would say that they weren't supposed. The special effects guy only put a claw in that particular image, so you wasn't supposed to see a face. Which I've always thought was fantastically interesting.
Ooh. That's one of those great made-for-TV movies.
It is. It was very well done, and simply because you can't see who's behind the wheel, if there's anyone behind the wheel of that vehicle, and what it does is, especially when it laughs with the horn, it's just fantastic.
And though all not made for TV, didn't really do anything until it went to TV, Duel was a good movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, where you don't see who's driving.
That's another disappointment, not with Duel. I love Duel, but with Spielberg, he did Duel, didn't he?
Yes.
That was his first feature.
Yep.
Right. Somebody posted a clip of him talking to AMC, one of the AMC guys from TV, about his career on Facebook. And he just started talking about Rod Serling and his first directing, he directed one of the first episodes of Night Gallery.
Yeah.
And he was just
That was his directing debut in one of the 3 parts of the Twilight Zone, the Joan Crawford part
of the Night Gallery
movie.
And he was just about to start talking about Rod Serling and how he can work with him. And then the guy cut him off and started going on something other. I just want to throw paper at him.
Yeah.
You're just about to get in some good juicy stuff, because he was saying, he started by saying, And, well, this is my first acting job with Mr. Serling. And when I started talking to Mr. Serling, then he cut him off and said, well, what about this? Oh, well, yeah. And he, oh, no.
Yeah, stop. There is nothing more important than Rod Serling. Go back.
Well, it's kind of like that article you read from Creighton Cheney or Lon Chaney Jr. about his father. Mm-hmm. You just want to hear more about the people that you admire, off screen. Even if they're, some of the stuff you hear is not good, like poor Lugosi. Poor Lugosi had a really miserable life after a couple of bad breaks, and then he got hooked on heroin.
Also one of the first, though, to publicly go into rehab.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
and to publicly announce
props
it
to him
came
for
out.
That.
Yeah.
But what he went through when he was younger, I guess a friend of mine is big into World War II. As I said, he's a tabletop gamer. And the battles that Lugosi were a part of when he was younger, before he got into acting, back during World War II, I guess, according to my friend, were some of the most brutal that you could get into. And my friend was really surprised that Lugosi came out of it as well as he did just to get into acting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Too long as you learn about this stuff.
There's some who say he may have stretched the truth, though. He did tell a lot of stories about the old country that some are like, come on.
That's true. He did like to exaggerate slightly. The only thing, I guess, from what I understand from people who met him, they did exaggerate on is the fact that he was always upset with Boris Karloff and his tea breaks.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, they did Son of Frankenstein together. That's his only debut was as Igor?
Yes.
Yes.
It was.
And I guess according to some fans of his who'd stopped by his apartment in California and actually saw him and talked to him, because they were such big fans of Lugosi. This is after he'd been divorced from his wife and stuff like that. He was alone. And I guess Lugosi had nothing bad to say about Karloff or anyone else except when they started talking about a Son of Frankenstein, in which case Lugosi would go on and on about how Karloff always had to have tea breaks. He didn't need any tea breaks. He could go on without tea breaks. But Lugosi always had to have his tea break.
Yeah. I'll tell you what,
that's
though.
Pretty cool.
They were in some great films together.
They were.
Black.
And there's a lot of people who thought that it was really harsh of Karloff not to go to Lugosi when he was in trouble in rehab. And I guess according to what I've heard of from Lugosi's daughter, not Lugosi, but Karloff's daughter, so I'm getting mixed up here.
Sarah,
Yeah, I guess Karloff didn't go to Lugosi or talk to him about it or offer him any aid because he thought that if he did, it would only advertise Lugosi's situation and make the man embarrassed.
That makes sense.
Hmm, okay.
That's what I heard. Whether it's 100% factual, who knows? But
I don't know. That's
yeah. You'd really love to be a fly on the wall for some of this stuff, so.
Oh, yeah. I would love to be a fly on the wall for a lot of history.
there's another thing I think personally that drove Lon Chaney Jr. into drinking as much as he did was the fact that the Universal or the film companies would not allow him to follow in his father's footsteps.
Yeah.
I guess one of his first films, he played a caveman not a historical drama, but you know what I mean.
1 Million BC, the first
version.
Yeah,
1 Million BC, there we go. And he wanted to do his own makeup for that. He wanted to do all of his own makeup. And I guess by then, the unions wouldn't allow him to do that. Because
he had dad's kit,
mm-hmm.
I believe.
And that haunted that same situation haunted him all the way through his career. Every time he wanted to try to do something his father did or better it or whatever it might be the case, they always stomped on it. Which I think is one of the reasons they might have driven him into the bottle more. But even when he was still drinking way too much, he was still a fantastic actor if you got him early.
Yeah.
Or even at the end, if you got him early in the day.
Yep.
You guys have probably seen Haunted Palace, I take it?
Yes, I have. It's
he's
been a
great
while,
in that film. Yeah, he's even with a short party head, he's just great in that film.
I even like him in it's a really campy film, but Spider Baby.
Oh, yeah, Spider Babies. Yeah, that's a really – he really did a nice job in that one, too. But even according to him, his own lines were, if you want him, you got to get him in the morning.
Yeah.
When he did House of Frankenstein with who played Frankenstein? Glenn Strange.
Yeah.
As a story, I know I heard about that particular movie where they were getting close to the end of the shooting, and Glenn Strange was in this mud pit up to his knees because that's when they sank, in the quicksand at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to block him or mark him. And everyone was cutting out for lunch, so he actually literally, Glenn Strange, had to stay in that pit.
God!
And it was cold. I guess it was really cold mud, Glenn Strange said. And so what happened was that Lon Chaney Jr., or Creighton Chaney, came up to him about midway through lunch, and Glenn Strange just shivered. He said, he's just cold and heck in there. And Chaney gave him this whole bottle of brandy and said, here, this will keep you warm. I guess by the time they came back from lunch, they couldn't film any. They couldn't shoot anymore because Strange was so intoxicated.
He was soused. Way to go, Glenn Strange. That'll teach him. That'll learn.
Yeti ended up being a bartender at the Kitty Saloon on Gunsmoke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did quite a
few of those westerns too.
Yeah.
Chaney was in a few westerns.
He had the face for Western, didn't he, Glenn Strange?
Yeah, he did. I agree. He had a really nice – I mean, people that played the bad guy in a couple of them where he wore the black hat. He actually really did a good job.
Yeah.
I just kind of wish between me, you, and the listening audience who might still be listening, I kind of wish people would dive into more of some of these older films that really deserve resurgence or at least notice. Like a great one was Bad Day at Black Rock.
Yeah.
And people just don't remember those films, and I just kind of caught it, it must have been a month or two ago on one of those movie channels, and it's just fantastic the way these actors put everything into it. They just, Spencer Tracy does a great job in that film.
Yeah, with one arm tied behind his back.
Yeah. Without
that's
Captain
why I love my Roku, I love my Roku because I find these channels that have old movies, some that maybe I haven't seen for years, or some that for one reason or another just escaped my notice growing up. And it's like a brand new movie. It's like the coolest thing ever. Sort of like listening to radio here with Dave, because I did not have that sharp interest in radio as a youth, and this is a period of discovery for me, really.
Oh, no, I agree. When I was a teenager, I didn't have much of an interest in radio programs either. I actually didn't develop that until I got past my 25th birthday.
Now I hit that in my teens. By junior high school, I was well into loving old radio.
That was
the dramas, the comedies, everything.
And it has a flavor. It has a very certain fun flavor to it. Even the campy ones have really fun flavors to them.
Oh, yeah. We'll toss in a comedy here and there. I mean, we predominantly go with, either creepy, horror, sci-fi, fantasy, something like that. But we'll dip into the westerns and the comedies and a few dramas here and there.
And I've got one trio of comedians who I know in the, it must have been early 80s. I think it's early 80s, yeah. They tried to kill, not kill physically, but they tried to chop, get rid of. So they thought they were too violent that they still can't destroy, can't keep them off the air as the Three Stooges.
Yes.
Yeah,
the heroes.
And they've tried everything, the censor people, whatever, whoever the stereotypical people are. They've tried everything to get rid of those guys because they're too violent or too this or too that. And their slapstick sense of humor is just too good. It's just too good.
Yeah,
well,
it is.
And their timing is just absolutely amazing. Working together, doing the stunts that they do, their timing is just unbelievable.
They had a lot of
opportunities to work on it, though, if you think about it, in the vaudeville days, you spent a lot of time doing nothing
Ed
but
Healy,
practice.
Weren't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
I just got done seeing one the other day while I was at work in the morning, since we have TV in the break room, where they were in Arabia. And I guess Curly was supposed to be this knife – not Curly. Yeah, Curly was supposed to be this knife thrower, and Larry was up against the wall. And,
cool.
yep. And Curly had these big, thick glasses on, and he just misses Larry's head with the dagger. So Mo runs up, takes the glasses off.
Is that
Curly
the one with
another...
Russia?
Yep. Yeah, that's it. And Curly okay. throws another knife and just about misses Larry, and Mo runs back, puts the glasses back on.
Yep. This is subtle things, but they were good. They there's a number of good books about the Stooges that I'm a proud possessor of. With I think his son-in-law was a publisher, and Norman Maurer, and great stuff, great photos of them growing up as kids.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen Curly's cousin? I guess he's his cousin or his nephew. I can't remember who's taking his place nowadays in appearances.
No.
Oh,
he's
looks
not aware.
Just like him. He sounds just like him. He looks just
God.
Like him.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah.
It is.
What was it? God, it wasn't AMC. I don't know. There was I can't remember the station I was watching a couple of months ago. They were running some old Stooges, and he was the host for the show. And I swear he sounds just like him.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Curly Howard. He was a comic genius in his odd little way.
Yeah, did you get any guys, either of you guys ever hear that he was a sounds like that he might have been not a manic depressive, but some type of depressive personality?
Well, he had long flowing hair, and it really did break his heart when Healy said, "That's it, you know, we're cutting off those locks and you're gonna look like this." Because he was a bit of a ladies' man. He was an accomplished ballroom dancer, Curly was. And I think that really, really hurt him.
So I did hear a couple of reports from people behind the scenes that after the skits were done, if Mo Howard wasn't there, if it was his brother, wasn't, I don't believe, I heard it was his cousin, but it might be his brother. But
no, it was his brother.
If Mo Howard wasn't there, then Curly would just go into his room and close the door and do nothing. You know, lock and listen to the radio or something like that. He'd just isolate himself from what I heard.
I could see that with him, because he was kind of lonely with again, his appearance being what it was.
Yeah.
He truly was a ladies' man. He was a lover of animals.
Oh, God, he loved dogs.
Oh, God, yeah. He would adopt them divided more than he could take care of.
Yeah, I guess his last wife said that every day or every time he'd go out for a walk, he'd come home with a new dog.
Yeah.
But it's a shame he suffered from mini strokes like that. That's what finally killed his career, is that he kept suffering from mini strokes to the point where he finally hit a massive one and he couldn't perform anymore.
Yeah. He did, and that is correct. Pretty sad, but his brother Mo took, you know, did his best to take care of him.
Yep, never forgot him. That's another good thing. Mo Howard could be a lot of stuff could be said about Mo Howard, but he was a family man. He never forgot his family.
Yeah,
yeah. And one thing about Curly that I heard that he often had trouble remembering his lines, so. You know, perhaps he was a bit dyslexic or something, because you do have trouble memorization. So what he would do, that's when he would throw himself on the floor, whoop, 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 go around in a circle. While he was doing that, he would remember what his next line was. Then he would get back up and they would do the, you know, he would continue on. But that was a vehicle that Curly devised to buy him some time to remember what his next line was supposed to be.
That's amazing.
And there are a lot of people who don't realize, at least these days, that don't realize that a lot of those pratfalls they did were real. They were staged, but they were real. There was an episode I heard of where they were on three boards up lifts.
Yeah.
You know, there's one, two, and three. And I guess Mo was on the top board, and the board was supposed to crack in half. It just didn't crack right, and he fell through two of the other boards onto the floor and broke three ribs.
Yeah. And he kept working.
And then he went to the hospital, and then the next day he was had with his ribs strapped. The next day he was back acting again.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
Yeah.
That was a period during the Depression, too, and they worked as much as they could. People don't realize today how much road work they did. They did a lot of live appearances.
So yeah, I tend to believe they were comic geniuses, all three of them together, Larry Devine and Mo and Curly. They knew their timing down. Their stunts were perfect and beautifully performed. How can you not laugh at some of that slapstick? It's just too hilarious.
Yeah.
Especially when you throw in the sound effects.
The effects made it really.
Like when they went into the basement to fix the leak, and they started adding pipes in order to shut the leak off, and the other pipe didn't have an end to it, so it started leaking.
Yep.
And at the end of the set, they were in this Rector set of pipes.
Yeah, and actually we paid tribute to that in one of our Spaceship One episodes. We were calling down to Al to fix the food regenerator because everything came out tasting like Spam. He was in the engineering room with all these pipes with water pouring out of all these different pipes. And that
awesome.
Was a tribute to the Three Stooges there.
Oh, that's great. That's one of the comedy routines that there are a certain group of people who've always tried to smash or get rid of, and the more they try to stop it, the more fans they get.
Well, you can't when violence is the point of the humor.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost tribal because I don't know if tribal is the right word, but like inherent in people to be that sense of relief that, boy, am I glad that didn't happen to me. Boy, that must have hurt, you know.
Well, Mo Howard put so much gusto into the fact of being the bully. Being everyone's bully. If you get my point, if you look at Mo Howard as being a bully, he's everybody's bully. He's the guy who bullied you when you were in school. He's
he didn't discriminate.
So that's why you don't dislike it when Curly or Larry Devine turns around and bangs him on the head or slaps him in the nose.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know, there's a very small, subtle the situation in there that I still think Mo Howard's trying to get across is the fact that, you know, bullying isn't good. This is the type of people you want to stay away from.
Or pay close attention.
That's what my mother always told me.
That's just my opinion, of course. But you know, Larry Devine, I guess he was supposed to be a jeweler originally when he was growing up. His parents wanted him to take over the jewelry store they had in New York.
Yeah. He would have played it on the dogs.
Probably.
Yeah, he's another one with a little bit of a gambling issue.
Oh, he had a bit of a gambling issue, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And then let's see, who was the second one who took Curly's place? That wasn't Curly Joe,
Shemp.
Was it?
Shemp.
Was it?
No,
it wasn't Shemp. That was the other Curly.
Oh, Joe Derita. Joe Derita.
Yeah, there we are. I guess Mo Howard hated him.
No, the Sissy Stooge was Joe Besser.
Besser was the one he hated.
That's the one I didn't care for.
Oh,
the Sissy Stooge, yeah.
Yeah, because I guess Besser always overslept for trains, and he was never quite on time. He didn't really care about the act so much as getting the money for the act, from what I understand. And so,
well, they got him because he was already under contract for the studio, so that's how they ended up with him. He wanted a man to... Mantan Moreland. And although that's been disputed, that's what Mo Howard insists, is that, he was strongly considered. The studio wouldn't buy it. And then they had, you know, so they had Joe Besser under contract, so he got the job.
Yeah, I guess from what I understand, Mo Howard disliked him to the point where he wouldn't wake him up when it was time to leave. So I guess Besser would never set his alarm, so Besser would always have to catch up to the other two because he'd always miss his trains or something like that.
Yeah, just let them be there.
Yeah. Good stuff. Another one I still love to watch is Laurel and Hardy. I still love to watch those guys, too. They're just hilarious.
They were probably some of my first comedy heroes that I really kind of studied and what they did and how they did things. And there's a lot of times I pay homage to Oliver Hardy by actually turning and looking at the camera for a second and then going back to what I was doing, like Oliver Hardy did many times.
Yeah, it's breaking the fourth wall, yeah.
Yep.
They were a great team, too, to watch. Sorry about that beep. Someone was trying to call me.
Didn't hear
it. But we don't need to talk to them.
Yep, so, yeah.
Otherwise, I'd be more than happy to ship you out those books.
I'll PM that address to you, Tim.
As will I, sir.
Definitely, I'd love to get your opinions on some of the short stories in those books and what you thought of it, of the central story that wraps it together. The only suggestion I have is that it's unlike a lot of other short story books. You have to read these stories in order to understand what the book's about.
Got it. Yeah, to follow along.
If you jump from story to story, like from the first story to the last story, you're going to be completely confused as to what the book's about.
So these were all written independently, and then you locked them all together, or they were written to be locked together.
No, they were all written independently. A friend of mine decided to start her own publishing company, she wanted to know if I had a book I wanted to put out. So I just took all those short stories and I locked the central story that brought them all together.
Neat.
And her husband, swore I couldn't do it.
I would think that too. I took a story that I co-wrote about a diary about a guy that went back to try and save Lincoln. And when I expanded that into a full half-hour radio drama, I said, there's no way I can make this diary last a half an hour or 20-some minutes. So what I did is I built a story around the diary and had the diary the center of focus. So I expanded the diary, but I also had the story around it that wrapped up the entire thing.
But I'd be fascinated to know which of the short stories you like the best, because I guess Pierce Anthony's favorite was, I think it was What Big Sisters Do. Oh, no, it was The Cave was his favorite. That was a fantasy one. In fact, he wanted me to write more of it. He wanted me to continue the story.
Ah, okay.
That's a true feather in your cap. If Pierce Anthony is saying, like... I need more of this. Yeah, you're doing pretty good.
I was really happy to hear from him, too. So I wrote him personally back, telling him how much I appreciated him writing a foreword for my book and how much I appreciated him reading it. And he wrote me back saying, I only call him how I see him.
That's nice. Well done, sir.
Thank you. I mean, as I said, it was really nice of him to actually do it. I was really impressed. If you like other parts of my work that aren't completed, short stories that are half completed, go to my website. As I said, thedarkcreatures.com, and I've got a whole bunch of half completed work that people could sample from my writing style that's in there. One particular one I really liked was A Little Girl from Amigo, and that was a Western horror.
A Western horror, okay.
Yeah, I started writing that after watching The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, what's funny is I noticed in 2 weeks we're doing one on Headless. The topic is Headless. And I needed another story. I found one on this. The show was a cross between a Cisco Kid and The Lone Ranger. And it's from 1935, and it's going to be absolutely hilarious. A fun thing to share here in 2 weeks. So.
Sounds like it.
So,
I'll definitely keep my eyes open for
to.
It.
Yep.
The Little Girl from Amigo it's an excerpt from a larger book I was working on with a friend of mine called the The Dutchman, and I basically took the vehicle for writing that particular book that I didn't finish, unfortunately, with my friend, as being kind of like, what is it called, the Flying Dutchman of the West. So he's just an individual who rides on a horse chasing after another evil individual with no background himself. You never hear exactly where he came from or why he was there. Just that he's chasing after Hickory Stitch, which is the guy who was the evil of the novel. So Amigo was a town in which Hickory Stitch passed through, and if you get the reference from Hickory Stitch, both of those are names for the devil. Old classic names for the devil.
Ah, that's true.
Okay.
Old Hickory and Stitch. Mr. Stitch. I like playing wordplay like that, so if you ever run across that in a novel on one of my novels and you're wondering if I intentionally did that, yes, I intentionally did that.
That's good.
There you go.
That's good. I like that kind of wordplay and mind play. Puns are fun,
like,
too.
Like in the grand game, I introduced a new character since the game's expanded, and a new human character, his name was Harvey Gaines. Harvey and Gaines. Harvey is the first name of one of the producers of Creepy Magazine, and Gaines was the last name of the guy who helped create that. Yeah, Erie. Yep.
Yeah.
I think it was Erie. Mm-hmm.
Yep. EC Comics. Bill Gaines.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
He came up with all those horror comic books before they were cool.
Oh yeah, they were cool. That was one of the ones that got axed though when that Wortham guy came out with that book just trying to just destroy comic books.
Stupid censors.
Yep.
Believe it or not, I've got a 19. I think it's got to be probably 19. It wouldn't be 60s. It'd probably be 1950s DC House of Secrets comic book in plastic.
Ooh. Those are fun. House
and
of
it's
Secrets.
A fun one, too.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I went around and picked up a whole bunch of those old black and white Vampirella comics that when you could still get your hands on them.
Oh, I used to have a bunch of them. I should have hung on to those.
Yeah, because I'm an aficionado of black and white, as you can tell, black and white artwork. And the black and white artwork in those magazines were fantastic. They were detailed.
There were
many
of them, Tim. There was, like, Marvel had a bunch of them. I liked Tales from the Zombie. Did you ever see those, Tales from the Zombie? Big black and white Meg.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I still got a bunch of them. They're great. Good story. I like the storyline to it.
And unfortunately, one of my favorite artists of all time, praise be his name, passed away the other day. Perez, George Perez.
Oh, I did not know he passed.
I just heard it on Facebook a couple of days ago, I got introduced to his artwork on the Teen Titans in the 80s. Him and Marv Wolfman were working on. I don't know if you're familiar with those names, but
yes, I am. Marvel. Marvel.
He did a fantastic job with those comics. I mean, whenever you saw a George Perez artwork, you know, he did a full page artwork. You can look in the windows of that and see people doing stuff.
Yeah. A lot of detail. Oh God, I miss those old black and white mags though. Those were fun.
Oh, and the storytelling was just fantastic. You can tell where I got all my upbringing from for storytelling. It's all this old stuff that I'm into now.
The Warren magazines were good. There were a lot of, those were all black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And Heavy Metal magazine. Heavy Metal magazine was cool.
Just don't watch Heavy Metal 2000. It's a terrible replacement for Heavy Metal.
the first movie wasn't too bad. 2000 reeked.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And then they tried to pass it off as being, directly related to the first first movie, and you watch that thing, it's nothing like the first movie. This is nothing related to the first movie.
No, it really wasn't. Even the wraparound story just didn't really connect with it.
Nope. Yeah, if you're gonna sell something like that to me, you better deliver what you're selling to me. Otherwise, you're gonna
we like a lot of the same stuff.
As I said, I'm into that stuff big time. I've been into it since I was 10 years old. I used to watch the Universal Monsters with my father when I was younger. That's how I got to see The Thing from Another World, Frankenstein and the Wolfman. I saw all those. Them.
them.
Yeah. Little girl. Them. Anyway, sorry. Sorry about that.
But it also has one thing about Them. It has one of the greatest movie lines of all time.
Take me aside to Jack's food.
Do you remember that part?
Yep.
Oh, my God. And I think Fess Parker's in it briefly. He plays like a pilot who the government is like keeping under wraps because he insists he saw some flying spaceship thing. It was actually the ants that were migrating.
Oh, yeah, the queen and stuff. I just saw a great one I haven't seen in ages. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this one. Pop up on Sci-Fi Retro, which is a Facebook page I'm part of. The Bamboo Saucer.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's a very low-budget sci-fi film about a government agency who finds this buried saucer in the snow of the Andes, I think it is. Oh, yeah. My God, it's fantastic. It has very little special effects to it, but they just pull the story all right along. It's just beautifully done for a low budget.
Good stuff. Hmm.
I highly recommend you look into it, my friend, because I think you'd really like it.
It's been ages for me for that one.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I saw it, too.
The bamboo what?
The bamboo saucer. Bamboo saucer.
Saucer, okay.
Early sci-fi flick. Yep.
And another great one that a friend of mine picked up on one of those 50 greatest B-movies collections you can get is,
yeah.
I do believe it's called the 24th Day.
27th Day, I think it's called.
27th Day, okay. Sorry, I always get that number wrong. I apologize.
I think. Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, there's some
odd... No, we're not
odd...
careful here.
Yeah, no.
And I grew up with all this stuff, so, I mean, when I get a chance to reconnect with it, I jump at it.
Oh, gosh.
So in the 80s, for instance, when One Step Beyond disappeared, I thought for sure that it was gone for good. And then, of course, I reconnected with it about 2 or 3 years ago on Amazon. I'm like, God, it's back out. And then I found they had a set, so I had to run off and buy the set because I didn't want it to disappear.
Yeah.
Can't let it get away.
Yeah. I've done that way too much in my life every once in a while. You see something and, well, I just should probably wait and pick it up later. And guess what? There is no later.
I may never see it again.
Yep.
Yep, I know that feeling. It's a good feeling, though.
Well, guys, I'm going to have to...
Yeah, this has been... Tim, this has truly been a joy... And entertainment and an education all one time tonight. I want to thank you for being here.
Yep.
I want to thank you for having me.
and as guests, there is one thing that since CW has signed off now that the guests have to do close off for the show.
Yep.
And you have to bring out the one, the only Mr. Jimmy Durante to close out the show.
Yep.
So I'd like you all to thank you all for having me on this wondrous radio program to talk about wondrous things of mysterious and depths and strangeness and those one step beyond moments which no one really realizes they're having until they've had them. So you all have a good night and thank you very much for this wonderful time.
And that's a perfect intro for James.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
It's time to say good night. What more to say but good night? We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Arrivo, up we the same, and ink-a-dink-a-doo. Good night. Good night. Good night, folks, and good night.
night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
Do you mind turning off the radio?